You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something drastic had to be done, and that drastic something from the standpoint of the U.S. Oligarchy or the patriarchs is called Donald Trump. And the job of Donald Trump is, through deception, to split Russia from China. You have to divide and rule. That combination is something the U.S. cannot defeat as long as it's growing. So they have to start making a courtship of Putin and say, listen, let's make a deal, like Trump would say.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Incredible Trump Deception. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwest University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Today we examine some of the early political appointments of the new Trump administration and the geopolitical shift in American foreign policy that it represents. William Engdahl, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you, Bonnie.
Your latest article is entitled The Dangerous Deception Called the Trump Presidency. Donald Trump put forth some populist ideas in his presidential campaign, such as his goal to have good relations with Russia, his criticism of the vicious ISIS jihadis, support for rebuilding domestic infrastructure, among others. What do you consider to be the dangerous deception?
The dangerous deception is, number one, Donald Trump, who he is as a person, is not at all what the American people or the world really is hoping. He is a complete showman work of stagecraft. That being said, we have to look behind the people who are elected president. Look at how it was with Obama when he came in on the banner of, and what did he do? The first thing he did was ramp up the Afghan war with 30,000 troop surge, the Petraeus strategy. And ever since then, he's been in the Arab Spring, wars across the Middle East, destruction of Libya, trying to destroy Syria. Every single financial appointment of Obama was dictated by Robert Rubin and the people at Goldman Sachs and Citigroup. So we've had that experience with Obama, and now we have this thing called the Trump presidency. Well, we as human beings love to hope. We love to have hopes. And I know so many normally intelligent people, commentators, analysts like myself, who have a sense of world politics, who are just taken in by this shill called Donald Trump. The man's, look at his background, and this I did back in March, April, in a piece I wrote on my website called The Mafia Dog. Donald Trump is a protege of organized crime. His mentor was a mafia lawyer in New York named Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn, who's famous, infamous in the Joseph McCarthy hearings back during the 50s in the Cold War, Roy Cohn was a lawyer for the mob. He was connected with the Cardinal Spellman of New York, back in the 50s and the 60s, one of the leading architects of the Cold War. But, let's say he underwent a remarkable transformation. Then we have to look a little bit into who are the people around Donald Trump. In my view, Donald Trump is pure showtime. He's a choice of what I call the American patriarchs, the David Rockefellers, George Soros, and so forth. And the idea that a maverick, a real upsetter, a man of the raw blue-collar working people who's going to reverse all these trade policies and do this and that and the other thing and make America great again, even though the banks of Wall Street aren't going to like it, and the military, industrial, whatever, that the people like David Rockefeller would sit there and have their jaws open and say, my God, we can't do anything to stop this Trump phenomenon. What a crock, what a nonsense. You know, wake up, look at this. This was orchestrated. Probably the Hillary thing was orchestrated as a part of the same theater. But certainly the Cruz and Rubio and Ben Carson and Jeb Bush, you know, they were all given their roles to play, that Trump would emerge as this phenomenon. And, you know, he certainly did, but with the full support of the critical media going attacking Trump, so that the man on the street would think, oh, this guy is against the Main Street establishment. Let's look at him more closely. Well, let's take a look at this grassroots revolution of Donald Trump in the form of the people he's appointed. Take, for example, Mike Flynn, 3-star general, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Supposedly, we're told he was fired from DIA by the Obama administration because he objected to the demonization of Putin and Russia and thought the military of the United States should focus more on ISIS and the Islamic terrorism in the Middle East. Well, Mike Flynn he will be now the National Security Advisor. He is reportedly sitting next to Donald Trump and making the decisive votes on who shall be the other key figures for the Trump administration in terms of defense, national security, and so forth. So Mike Flynn, we're told that he's a good guy because he later admitted, after being in favor of the invasion of Iraq by Bush in 2003, said that was actually a mistake, looking back on it, a strategic mistake. Not a tragic mistake, but a strategic. He's a military man. Okay. The Flynn policy is connected very much with the policies of Benjamin Netanyahu. And this may shock some of your listeners, but let's go to another person, Waleed Fares, who's Trump's advisor on terrorism in the Middle East. Well, Waleed Fares gave an interview in the Egyptian press where he said that Donald Trump plans to back legislation to outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, keep in mind, Huma Abedin, the right-hand, I don't know what you want to call her, of Hillary Clinton for the last, since she was 19 years old, the estranged wife of Mr. Wiener, the former congressman, Huma Abedin is a Muslim brother. She's a member of a death cult out of Egypt called the Muslim Brotherhood. Her mother is a Muslim brother. They call it the sisterhood because it's an all-male society. But there are females, and Huma and her mother are members of that female branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's a terrorist organization. It's the mother organization to the Mujahideen, to Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden. It's a CIA project that goes back to the 1920s in Egypt, but when British intelligence was working with them. And this now is on the bad list, of apparently, of the Trump presidency. But look more closely at who is Waleed Fares, the advisor of Trump. You know, he didn't just drop out of the trees somewhere. He's a senior fellow on a very small and highly politicized think tank in Washington called the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Now, the FDD, let's call it the FDD, was set up in the wake of September 11, 2001. The money bags for it come from the notorious Sheldon Adelson, a friend of Donald Trump, and the Las Vegas and Macau gambling casino billionaire, who gave the Trump campaign $25 million in the closing days, and who also is the main financial supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli Likud. Other backers of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where Trump's Middle East terrorist advisor comes from, include the whiskey heirs Samuel and Edgar Bronfman, Wall Street billionaire speculators Michael Steinhardt and Paul Singer. Every single one of them are Israel first, Netanyahu, Likud connected. The vice president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies is a man called Toby Dershowitz. He spent 14 years as AIPAC communication head. For those of you who don't know, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee has been described by John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago as, quote, an agent of the Israeli government with a stranglehold on the United States Congress with its power and influence. Donald Trump was a featured speaker in the March 2016 AIPAC annual meeting, as, of course, was Hillary. Okay, now let's slowly go back to Mike Flynn, the man who will head up the National Security Council, but his plan is to change the powers of the National Security Council and the advisor to the president to make him the sole powerful figure of the entire U.S. intelligence community with power to hire or fire. If the director of the CIA doesn't suit his liking, he's gone. This is the bill that Mike Flynn is advocating in the Trump presidency. We'll see how that goes. And Flynn agrees that the Iran nuclear deal that Obama made with Iran should be scrapped. He calls Iran a state sponsor of terrorism. That's something that Netanyahu finds very nice. But here's the interesting thing. For those of you who have a memory that goes back to the 1970s and world geopolitics, Flynn co-authored a book that was published earlier this year with a man named Michael Ledeen. Now, I'm an author. I've written 9 books in over the years, and you don't just co-author a book with any bloke on the street. You have to have someone whose thoughts are in full harmony with yours, otherwise it doesn't work. Well, who is Michael Ledeen? He's also a freedom scholar at, well, isn't this interesting, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. CIA Director James Woolsey III, frothing at the mouth neocon, who talked about a 30-year war after 9/11 and who's rumored for some top position in the Trump project, is a member of the FDD, Foundation for Defense of Democracy Leadership Council. So now we begin to get an idea. This whole foreign policy of Trump, let's step back a little bit. A year ago, the foreign policy strategy that had been followed since 9/11 by George W. Bush Cheney, by Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton et al., was a catastrophic failure. The decision by Washington to create a coup d'etat in Ukraine to drive a wedge between the European Union, especially Germany, and Russia to break the economic links that were growing very, very strong because it's a natural fit. Well, that coup d'etat had a backfire effect, a boomerang effect. It drove Russia closer to China, and it created the geopolitical nightmare that Zbigniew Brzezinski talks about in his famous 1997 book, The Grand Chess Game. The cohesion of the states of Eurasia. Now, if anyone takes out a map and looks at the land space of Russia, which goes all the way to the Pacific, Vladivostok, and the land space of China, and look at the countries in between who are all members of something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the fact that China is building a network of high-speed, cutting-edge, state-of-the-art railways infrastructure crisscrossing all of this space, including Russia, then we begin to see that the patriarchs or the oligarchs who viewed the United States as their kind of platform to destroy the world and destroy nation states all over the world, they were beginning to lose everywhere. And when the president of a small country, the Philippines, which has been occupied by the United States since 1898, calls the president of the United States the son of a whore, then you know that the credibility and the influence, the soft power of the United States is really hurting.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Incredible Trump Deception. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So everywhere, Turkey, after the failed CIA coup with Fethullah Gulen back in July this year, Erdogan began making very, very strong moves toward cooperation, not only with Russia, but with the Shanghai Cooperation countries, with Eurasia, and it's a natural fit. Turkey's future isn't the European Union. The European Union is collapsing. It's falling apart. Turkey is beginning to sense its economic future lies with Russia, lies with cooperation with China, and the high-speed rail links. It would be a natural fit for the Turkish economy. So something drastic had to be done, and that drastic something, from the standpoint of the U.S. Oligarchy or the patriarchs, the silly old patriarchs, as I call them sometimes, is called Donald Trump. And the job of Donald Trump is, through deception, to split Russia from China. You have to divide and rule. That combination is something the U.S. cannot defeat as long as it's growing. So they have to start making a courtship of Putin and say, listen, let's make a deal, like Trump would say, and whisper pretty things in the ears of Vladimir Putin. And most Russians, the Russian media, I know I travel to Russia quite often. My books are translated in Russian language, my articles as well, and I know many, many Russians. The Russian media is probably more pro-Donald Trump than the U.S. media. They think this is finally, they're, you know, so tired of this, every bad thing that happens in the world is because of Putin. It's like being mobbed, and finally here comes Trump, and he starts whispering friendly things. But that's the game, to shift away from the Muslim Brotherhood card that was the Obama administration geostrategy, using radical Islam as a proxy for expanding empire, if you want to call it, to using Israel, using the Mossad, using the Israeli Defense Forces, and all of the geopolitical leverage that Israel has in the Middle East and other places, which is considerable, as their strategic weapon. At the same time, this thing about making America great again, more and more, it's becoming clear what Trump and his economic advisors are talking about is a Reagan kind of rebuilding of the American military might. The Navy has been allowed to deteriorate over the past 25, 30 years significantly. The spending on the Pentagon is so out of control. The Auditor General last summer, Inspector General, who is responsible for the audits of the branch service branches, certified that there was $6.5 trillion of U.S. Army expenses in recent years that doesn't have a paper trail. There is no audit trail possible. $6.5 trillion. Look at this all-purpose, all-service fighter jet that's going to cost taxpayers $1.3, $1.5 trillion for something that's a heap of junk, doesn't work. So with a shoestring budget after the invitation to intervene in Syria against the terrorists, Russia demonstrated that with a shoestring budget, they had developed military technologies that are bleeding edge, not just the state of the art, bleeding edge, and literally shocked the Pentagon military strategists at what Russia has accomplished in the last 10 years quietly. But when the U.S. announced that it was going for missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic in 2007, if you recall, then Vladimir Putin in his first presidency was invited to Munich for the International Security Conference, annual conference. He gave a speech, and he said to say that this missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic is aimed at rogue states like Iran or North Korea is, as we say in Russia, like using your right hand to scratch your left ear. It's nonsense. This is aimed at Russia, and it is aimed at Russia. So ever since that time, of course, it's greatly expanded. NATO troops are being mounted on the border of Russia. The U.S., Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary for Eastern Europe and Europe, and Turkey also, by the way, brought a bunch of neo-Nazis into the regime in Kiev when they ousted the democratically elected president. He may have been a thief, but he was democratically elected thief, and put in a bunch of fascist oligarchs that are simply looting and plundering Ukraine and making war against the eastern parts of Ukraine. It's a failed state. That is the U.S. handwork. That's the Washington project. So something had to be done. And that something is what you see shaping up with Trump. They're going to make China into the enemy image. They're going to try to split off Russia through hook and crook, through disinformation, through who knows what. They'll probably lift the sanctions at some point to try to get Russia off guard and try to sow seeds of discord between Russia and China. And then with that, they're going to target China massively. They've already begun it with this so-called accidental phone call between Trump and the president of Taiwan, breaching some 40 years of diplomatic protocol. So this is the Trump presidency. Michael Ledeen is the godfather, the co-author with Flynn of this book. He's the godfather of the neoconservatives. He's the mentor of Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, the war faction of George W. Bush. This is Donald Trump.
You've described the Trump presidency as the install a plan B president. So
yeah.
You've kind of started to talk about what plan B is. You have mm-hmm. written that Donald Trump was put into office to prepare America for war.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the people that have been listening to his campaign would probably not think that. But
sure.
What in your
he wants to win the power. It isn't the people behind him want to win the power. They don't want to freak the population out.
Well, what in your view would this war look like, and what would be the time frame? And maybe you can talk about that in conjunction with some of these other cabinet appointees. I mean,
sure.
he's got quite a few of them now.
Yeah. I think what they realized is that the banks of Wall Street, the financial crash of 2008, the fact that the six criminal banks of J.P. Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America and so forth have been on artificial life support now for 8 years at 0.25 interest rate of the Fed. This isn't a military base to win a war. What Russia did in Syria, that tiny little shoestring budget that they deployed in Syria, if that's combined with the military buildup that's going on in China, then you have the capacity to defend the Eurasian land space against anything the United States can say. Keep in mind the agenda of people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, the agenda of David Rockefeller, the agenda of these oligarchs, and I assume that your listeners understand the term oligarch, because that's what these people are. They're patriarchs, really. Their agenda is new world order, one world government, global. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is their agenda. David Rockefeller even stated so in his autobiography several years ago. He said, if this is the charge I'm charged with, I'm proud of it. So, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, back in the 70s, in his Technotronic Era book, writes about the fact that the nation state has to be eliminated. So who are the strongest nation states on the face of the earth today? China, Russia, Iran. And the three of them are cooperating in a way that never has taken place before. So this is the war that they are preparing for. I think my own guess is that it will take between 4, 6, 8 years, something in that time frame. It won't work in the end. It's a failed strategy, but that's all they know. Their mentality is going back to 1939 and Roosevelt and the military buildup for World War II. That's the template that they have in their mind, is that we just do that again with modern technology and blah, 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 blah. So it's already Trump has pledged the biggest naval buildup under his presidency since the huge naval buildup of Ronald Reagan. And, you know, you look at the Secretary of State for the first time since George Marshall, the beginning of the Cold War, there is a retired military general as defense secretary. There had been a tradition to always have a civilian as head of defense. Now we've got a man who's known as the warrior monk, Mad Dog Mathis. The man, I would say, if I were a clinical psychologist, I would call him a psychopath from statements he's made and things he's done. The soldiers love him. When you're in the trenches, he jumps down there with you. That's said to be the case. So this is really not a group of pacifists that is coming around Trump. I think what you're going to see, the choice of Wilbur Ross as Commerce Secretary, together with his campaign manager, Steve Mnuchin, former partner at Goldman Sachs, as was his father. Steve Mnuchin, a former partner with the Soros Fund Management of George Soros. Steve Mnuchin, a business associate of Donald Trump, going back to Trump's casino days. They are going to create probably some kind of a national infrastructure bank or fund. They're going to have a strong dollar policy the way Bush Sr. had, or actually Reagan Bush, from 1980 until about 1985, when the dollar got so high it was threatening everything, and they had this Plaza Accord meeting and had Japan bring the dollar down. But the policy will be to start interest rate increases, with Europe in the critical bad shape it's in, especially after the Italian referendum, the European bank crises, and so forth. It won't take much to create a massive capital flight out of the Eurozone into where you're going to go, U.S. dollar. Trump's building infrastructure, their new projects. So there's going to be hundreds of billions of dollars coming into the dollar. That'll drive the dollar up as well. That'll suck capital out from China. That'll suck capital out from the emerging markets, the BRICS countries, and so forth. And it's going to be as simple as that, I think. It's Wilbur Ross. He cut his teeth for about 14 years, as I recall, for Rothschild Incorporated, the New York arm of the British and French Rothschild Banking Group, restructuring bankrupt companies. So he's going to restructure bankrupt America, perhaps. But it has as their aim to rebuild, as the Project for the New American Century said back in 2000, rebuild America's defenses for war, not just to play Monopoly or dominoes or something.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Incredible Trump Deception. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. It's interesting what you're saying about their economic plan, because I was reading a financial analyst on the internet who's trying to sell his analysis to investors.
Yeah.
And he was saying exactly the same thing, basically that Europe is headed down and that there's going to be flight capital out of Europe into a safe haven, and it's going to create a stock market boom in the U.S.
Yeah. It's so clear to me that people, you know, most of the intelligent people I speak with here in Europe, where I live in Germany, they just don't get it. They can't quite see where it's headed. But today, the Prime Minister of Italy resigned because he lost a referendum. The Renzi government resigned. Now the Italian banks are on critical life support from the European Central Bank, whose head happens to be Italian, happens to be former Italian head for Goldman Sachs, Mario Draghi. And the French banks are holding so much Italian state bonds, the debt of Italy. So if Italy's bonds start going belly up, the French banks will start coming under critical attack. Greece is still not solved. You have elections next year in France with a very strong nationalist party, Le Pen, Marine Le Pen. Just everywhere you look, Europe is in a shambles. It's in dissolution. The Euro project is a catastrophic failure. I was critical of it from the get-go back during the 1990s when it was formulated. You cannot have a currency without national sovereignty. So I think that's going to be the trend. You're going to see the euro dramatically falling, capital flight into the dollar, and that capital is going to be deployed. I'm sure there will be tax favors for investing in infrastructure to make America great, this infrastructure fund that Trump has mentioned. And much like the REITs during the 1980s that created the real estate bubble, you're going to have that with investment in infrastructure. You get a tax advantage for investing in building a high-speed rail network in the east coast of the U.S. or the west coast, I don't know. But it's all going to be one way or another connected to rebuilding America's defenses. And people are going to be happy because they have some real high-tech jobs for the first time in 15, 20 years maybe. And they won't look so far beyond that to see that they're preparing for the next world war. So that's I ask your listeners to note what I'm saying, read my article for the details, and store it away in the back of your mind and come back in 6 months or 12 months and see if what I'm saying is correct or not. See if we're not step by step rebuilding America's defenses.
Now, with regard to another big war, you've mentioned, of course, James Mattis to be defense secretary. His nickname of Mad Dog is a bit unnerving. I read that he was in charge of the vicious scorched earth policy in Fallujah, Iraq.
Yes. He's a mad dog. He developed the U.S. government's counterinsurgency guide, COIN is called in shorthand. And this is the warfare method that Petraeus implemented in Iraq and Afghanistan that created the ISIS. It created the ISIS. So this guy is pretty scary as a human being from everything I've seen on him. He ordered, just to take one example, in 2004 in Iraq near the Syrian border, he ordered a bombing at 3 a.m. in the morning of a suspected safe house near the border in Iraq. And it later came to be known as the Mukarradib Wedding Party Massacre. 42 civilian men, women, and children at a wedding celebration were simply blown to smithereens. And Mattis later said it took me 30 seconds to decide to bomb that location. No remorse whatsoever. No remorse whatsoever. The man is a psychopath. So, you know, point him at an enemy. Yeah, it's just, this is a little bit, you know, you want a steady hand at the head of the Pentagon, because this is a powerful force. And if you have someone of this kind of disposition, he lives to kill.
Of course,
he's very good at it, I'm sure, but, you know.
Of course, the civilian command at the Pentagon hasn't been exactly pacifist.
Well, no, they've all been neocons.
Yes.
In the recent years, but Ash Carter, you know, he's just a democratic neocon. Nothing, you know, even hidden about that.
Let's talk about the Islamic jihadis and the Muslim Brotherhood. Now,
Okay. According
to your analysis, and let's say Trump as president representing Plan B, you write that the decades-long CIA and Pentagon policy of training Muslim Brotherhood and other fanatic Muslim-origin terrorists to wage surrogate wars of empire have backfired badly. You write about a shift in Washington policy away from using Muslim Brotherhood towards more intimate restoration of full cooperation with Israel's right-wing Netanyahu-Likud government. What is the evidence for this shift? And what I'm also wondering about, my understanding is that Israel itself was also supporting these jihadis.
Yes, that's true. They have dirty hands in all of this as well. I think the main thing we're going to see, and you can see it, Mad Dog Mattis, the designate defense secretary, Flynn, the national security director designate, and the CIA designate, all are agreed that the main problem, the principal threat to stability in the Middle East, even above Al-Qaeda or ISIS, is Iran. So I think we're going to see a shift, which is very much what Netanyahu would love to see, toward a direct targeting of Iran by the U.S. and of the Hezbollah, which is supported by Iran in Syria and elsewhere, and, you know, try to really weaken Iran as much as possible. Because if you have a triangle, look at a map and you'll see this much more clearly. If you have a triangle of economic ties across a land space, the whole subject of geopolitics, the word is often misused, but it's geography and politics. And Halford Mackinder, the British architect of the theory of geopolitics back in 1904, described basically two kinds of power in the world militarily. Land power, and that is defined by the heartland, Russia or China and Russia, Eurasia. And you have sea power, and that originally was the British Empire, control of the seas. And after World War II, it became the United States, with the British as kind of a junior partner in that alliance. The focus will be to weaken or break Iran from this infrastructure triangle that's building up with Russia, Iran, and China around the high-speed railways and so forth, and also go after China in the South China Sea with trade war threats, currency wars, and so forth, and then slowly escalating toward more military confrontation against China. But I think they'll use economic warfare, the U.S. Treasury terrorism division that was devising the sanctions against Russia will probably come into play fairly soon. for the Trump administration. But they're going to mainly go after the Netanyahu agenda to knock Iran out of the power game in the Middle East, because Israel has very good leverage over Saudi Arabia. Keep in mind that Obama, to get the Iran deal, had alienated the Netanyahu government. Netanyahu defied the White House and made a special joint address to both houses of Congress before the Iran deal was approved finally, and the White House was furious. So the Obama strategy, Muslim Brotherhood et al., had really alienated Israel, and it had alienated Saudi Arabia in a huge way. So now I think we're going to see Saudi Arabia, Israel, and they're going to try to bring Erdogan back into the family of NATO. Because if Erdogan continues integrating with the Shanghai Cooperation countries, which is Russia, China, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, the Central Asian republics, then a key pillar of NATO in the Middle East is gone. So it's a very, kind of delicate, tricky situation.
I'm speaking with international political analyst, economist, and author F. William Engdahl. Today's show, The Incredible Trump Deception. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
If they put Iran in the crosshairs, mm-hmm. and you are saying that it would probably start out with some sort of increased economic sanctions, mm-hmm. they're going to be against the deal with Iran, etc. If they're at the same time cozying up to Russia, Russia wouldn't be too happy about an attack on Iran.
Not at all.
No. So do you think this would go so far as a military attack on Iran?
I think that's a little bit down the road, because it's highly, highly dangerous for the West and for Israel's security itself, especially since Iran has these S-400 anti-missile batteries that Russia supplied them beginning this year. So, they can prevent Israeli jet attacks or bombing attacks in crucial areas. But I don't think they're going to go for immediate military action in any of these places. They're not ready. That's the whole point about, the rebuilding, making America great again, rebuilding the infrastructure. They need to have a period of years, several years, maybe four, maybe six, maybe eight. I this is just a guess, to get the industrial base to launch a sustained war against two of the most powerful nations on earth, Russia and China.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds pretty questionable whether they're going to be able to do that. Do you think it's even possible?
I think it's, in the end, it's going to fail. If you think about it, all of the solutions to keep I wrote a book, maybe we talk about it at some future point, called The Lost Hegemon,
yes.
whom the gods would destroy. And the lost hegemon is the patriarchs or the oligarchy of the United States, that as the sole superpower, as Father Bush proclaimed when he collapsed the Soviet Union in 1991. By the way, I'm writing a book on that. George Bush Sr. and a network of CIA old boys around Bush corrupted several KGB generals, staged a fake coup to put Yeltsin in, and Yeltsin created the oligarchs together with the CIA to loot Russia and destroy the nation. And it was only in 1999 when, through kind of shrewd maneuvering, a unknown politician and former KGB officer named Vladimir Putin became president. So, this is fascinating history, but Putin is not naive. I'm convinced of that. And I think he'll take the use out of any kind of thaw in relations with the Trump presidency and be friendly and listen carefully. But in the end of the day, he's not naive. He's one of the shrewdest politicians that I've ever seen. And I've seen him two times now in person in St. Petersburg, when I was invited to speak at a major international economic forum there. And he address the plenum, one time with Charlie Rose, and one time with Fareed Zakariyyah. Is that right? The Newsweek.
Yes, I think I saw a clip from that myself.
Yeah. And in both cases, they tried to get under Putin's skin, and he just, you know, like a judo expert, he just, you know, knocked them on their backside. So he's very, very sharp, very well prepared, very clear about the things under his responsibility, and he's not naive. So I don't think the Russian press, I have many friends in Russia, the Russian press is euphoric over Trump, I would almost say. But I think little by little it's beginning to temper that. Partly my article was reprinted in the Russian media.
No, I saw a clip of Vladimir Putin from what you're talking about, and he was very cool and disarmed these questioners magnificently, yeah. I thought.
Oh, he's brilliant. And he does it with no notes. You know, it's not set up in advance.
No.
And some of the questions that Zakariyyah is, you know, one of these CIA media types. I don't know if he has a card from Langley, Virginia, but it doesn't need to. He's you know, complete establishment hatchet man. And he wanted to destabilize Putin in the worst sort of way about the Olympics, the doping, and so forth. And Putin just ripped him to pieces. He said, we don't know what those tests were because we had to get them to this Olympic doping testing agency, some I think in France, and we never saw them again. We couldn't cross-check them, and we had to take their word for it. Turns out that the agency who did those tests was corrupt. But, you know, everything was being done. And he didn't lose his cool. He just, you know, kept the high road. And Zakariyyah was really hard-pressed to do his job. But now it's going to be a very different kind of challenge, I think, for Russia and for the world.
With regard to the new Trump presidency and rebuilding the infrastructure, with interest rates going up, could you talk a little bit about how they would do this financially? Now, obviously, they're not going to mickey around with the Fed, right? I mean, they're going to leave that the way it is, I would think.
The Fed's going to be part of the game. The Fed's going to start raising interest rates probably in 10 days when they meet next, the 13th. They'll raise it 0.25%, then another 0.25% the next meeting in January or February, whenever it is. And they're going to do it gradually, but it's going to go upward, and that is going to create, because of the expectation, the way financial markets work, I've studied this now for over 30 years, it's the expectation of the next move that creates the action now. Mm-hmm. So I think they deliberately waited until after the election, and now you're going to have Trump setting up this infrastructure bank or fund. It's going to be a public-private partnership, as much as we know so far, and like a real estate investment trust in the 1980s, something that Trump knows very well. They're going to suck money in. They're going to probably give huge tax breaks to private investors to come into this, so it won't be pure taxpayer, you know, dollars that are involved in it. And frankly, that's how I would do it if I were. But I would really rebuild the peaceful infrastructure, not the military. In any case, so I think that's what we're going to see. And, you know, the independence of the Fed, the Fed rules Washington, not the other way around. It's the private bankers of Wall Street who own the Fed. They own the stocks of the Federal Reserve. It's a private bank, by the way. Most Americans don't know this. And its job is to support the agenda of six banks who have a balance sheet larger than the gross domestic product of 99% of the nations of this world since the repeal of Glass-Steagall and under Bill Clinton, President Clinton, in 1999. You know, these banks have just become so mammoth. The line is they're too big to fail, and I would say they're too big to save. They should be nationalized and chopped up into bite-sized pieces so that they don't blackmail the whole country and the whole world financial markets the way they do. But that's what they're going to try and see it quite clearly.
So when you talk about a Trump presidency rebuilding domestic infrastructure, you're referring to the military infrastructure. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you need to have aluminum production. Why not do this in America like we did in the end of the 30s with the, building all these hydroelectric dams on the West Coast? Now the water supply is a problem, but you need to have electric power to do this. You need to really ramp these things up and not be dependent on Chinese microchips for the American military. That's a little bit high risk if you're going to go to war against China in 5 or 10 years. So I think that's what they're going to do. And many people will say, oh, jobs again. Okay, I can go to work. I can regain my self-respect and feed my family, and kids can go to college, and who knows what.
I don't know if you want to say anything about Congressman Mike Pompeo of Kansas, the director of Central Intelligence. I think you mentioned him.
I mentioned him. The problem is very few people know anything about him. I assume he's one of these CIA types that's inserted into Congress, just kind of like sleepers. And then you don't bring an amateur in to be the head of the CIA.
Well, yeah, I mean, I never heard of the guy before, so you're making an excellent point.
Me too.
I mean, who's he?
Yeah. It's not like you're bringing in, Alan Dulles or, this is who?
But no, that's an excellent point you make. That must be what's going on.
Yeah. I think maybe we close with something that I researched her background. I'm going through all the cabinet, and it's amazing what comes up. But the education secretary, now education is something that I normally don't delve into. I have my thoughts on it, of course. But the secretary of education.
I looked her up. Her name is Betsy DeVos.
DeVos, you know Amway? Have you ever heard of Amway?
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, her husband is Amway. She's a billionaire, and her maiden name is Elizabeth Prince. Her younger brother is a man named Eric Prince, founder of Blackwater.
Wow.
there's not a... not a trick been missed here. And, it's one of these, I don't know if you're religious, but I'm trying my best to get away from religion that I grew up with. But she's part of this born-again Christian ideology, which is used to create wars. It's simply, this fake Christianity that I was astonished when I was in college in the late 60s early 70s, is the phenomenon. I grew up in Texas, and this born-again phenomenon, it's just staggering what power that took in the space of 10 years over the politics of America. And she's part of that, the host.
Oh, so you think she's a true believer?
No, they're not true believers. She's a true manipulator of true believers, I think. But anyway, it's, every single one, who's another one? Let's see. Every selection, the accidental phone call with Taiwan, nothing is accidental so far. They're planning every single thing. Now China is completely off balance. They're wondering is this guy just stupid? Is he unbriefed? And then Trump follows it up with a tweet. And they say, well, what is he doing tweeting? You send diplomatic cables, you don't tweet. This is really, it's really something rare.
Regarding the powers behind the Donald Trump candidacy, you think that there was a long-term plan behind all of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Even potentially that maybe Hillary Clinton wasn't informed, but there are pictures on the internet of Donald Trump and Bill Clinton playing golf together maybe 10 years ago, and you never saw two chummier friends. You know, these aren't ideological enemies. Someone told me years ago that before the 1992 campaign, Clinton against Bush Sr., that Clinton, as governor of Arkansas, had been invited 19 times to the Kennebunkport main compound of the Bush family to talk world politics. Yeah, it was very strange. So it's, I think, the vestiges of democracy kind of started withering on the vine after the assassination of the Kennedy brothers in the 60s. And since then, it's been step by step into a covert deep state, police state, whatever you want to call it, oligarchy.
William Engdahl, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I hope it was of use to your listeners, and I enjoyed it very much, Bonnie.
I've been speaking with F. William Engdahl. Today's show has been The Incredible Trump Deception. William Engdahl is an international political analyst, economist, and author. He is currently visiting professor of geopolitics at Northwestern University, Xi'an, China. Among his best-known books are A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, Gods of Money, Wall Street and the Death of the American Century, and Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, completing a trilogy on the power of oil, food, and money control. His book, Target China, How Washington and Wall Street Plan to Cage the Asian Dragon, has been a bestseller in Chinese. His latest book is The Lost Hegemon, Whom the Gods Would Destroy, about the CIA and political Islam. Visit WilliamEngdahl.com to sign up for a free bi-monthly geopolitical newsletter with significant content. He is launching a new monthly subscription audio seminar. That's WilliamEngdahl.com, William, ENGDAHL.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaramako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G, and our new world order is about to begin.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, part two of a fine talk by Vincent Emmanuel. It's about the three ongoing disasters of our time, and maybe a couple things we the people can do about them. I hope you'll stay tuned. Vincent Emmanuel was a fairly ordinary guy from the Midwest. Sharper than average, for sure, though that may have become obvious only later. After somebody attacked the World Trade Center, Emmanuel decided to stand up for America. So he enlisted in the United States Marine Corps, which sent him off to Iraq. Twice, in fact. In Iraq, he saw American forces engaging in needless brutality and serious war crimes. Of course, the invasion itself was a war crime. Emmanuel refused to go back for a third deployment. I'm not sure exactly how, but he and the Marine Corps somehow parted ways. He and the military-industrial complex parted ways. He and the national security state parted ways. He joined the organization Iraq Veterans Against the War and became one of its leaders. In last week's talk, Emmanuel spoke movingly about the collapse of the peace movement. The peace movement collapsed pretty much the moment Obama was elected in 2008. Anti-war organizations, to which Emmanuel had devoted years of hard work, just lay down and went to sleep. Maybe there never really was an anti-war movement in the 2000s, Emmanuel reflected. Maybe it was just an anti-Bush movement. I admire idealists. I especially admire idealists who stick with their ideals, even after those ideals fall out of fashion. Emmanuel never stopped his anti-war activism, but his concerns have broadened to include other issues. Best of all, he shows how the issues are interconnected. Well, I told you he was sharper than average. The obvious similarity here is with Martin Luther King near the end of his life. King came to realize that you can't talk about civil rights without talking about justice, and you can't talk about justice without talking about the excesses of corporate capitalism and about economic justice. And you've also got to talk about the infernal Pentagon war machine that has killed more black Americans than all the Southern sheriffs combined. The war machine that is sucking the funds out of anti-poverty programs like some gigantic demonic suction tube. Well, I'm not saying that Vincent Emmanuel is King's equal, but I do admire the way both of them see and explain the interconnectedness of our nation's problems. In his talk, Emmanuel discussed three interconnected problems. They are the collapse of American society, global militarization, and the environmental disaster, all of them now well underway. Last week, he discussed the collapse of American society and militarization, and just began his talk about ecology and the environment. This week, he'll focus on the environment and then reflect on steps the people can take to try to reduce the damage from all three. Note the stress on the people taking steps. The government has done almost nothing to halt any of the three disasters, and probably never will. Or so Emmanuel concludes, and I think he's right. In Orwell's 1984, the character Winston Smith says, "If there is any hope, it'll have to come from the proles." That's us. Here is Vincent Emmanuel.
Interestingly, the military is way ahead of the civilian state apparatus when it comes to climate change. A recent Guardian headline from 2 days ago reads, quote, "Military experts say climate change poses the most significant risk to security around the globe." A coalition of 25 prominent members of U.S. national state security community warned that higher temperatures and rising seas will inundate bases, because we have over 1,500 military bases, including in the United States, around the world, and fuel conflict, not to mention massive migrations on a level unprecedented in human history. Dar Jamail, in my opinion, one of the best reporters out there. I consider him a friend and someone that I think everyone should pay attention to his work. So Dar Jamail, reporting at Truthout, recently spoke to Dr. Peter Wadhams. That's Wadhams. I suggest checking out his work as well. So Dr. Wadhams suggests that Arctic sea ice could completely disappear in the next 2 years. This would be the first time in more than 10,000 years that Arctic sea ice has completely disappeared. The immediate consequences, according to Wadhams and Dar Jamail, includes, quote, "The loss from the shallow shelf areas north of Siberia is dangerous. Why? Because it encourages emissions of methane from the seabed as an offshore permafrost melts. Secondly, the loss from Baffin Bay and East Greenland in summer encourages warm winds over the Greenland ice sheet, which cause ice sheet melt and accelerated sea level rise." Recent headlines highlight Wadhams' warnings. Another Guardian article notes, quote, "A new study partly sponsored by NASA's Space Goddard Flight Center has highlighted the prospect that global industrial civilization could collapse in coming decades due to unsustainable resource exploitation and increasingly unequal wealth distribution." Even more conservative climate activists, such as Bill McKibben, routinely recognize that the severity of the situation increases with each passing moment. So this is an article published just 2 days ago in the New Republic. Bill McKibben writes, quote, "The future of humanity depends on math, and the numbers in a new study released Thursday are the most ominous yet. Those numbers spell out, in simple arithmetic, how much of the fossil fuel in the world's existing coal mines and oil wells we can burn if we want to prevent global warming from cooking the planet. In other words, if our goal is to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, the upper limit identified by the nations and scientists of the world, how much more digging and drilling can we do today? Well, here's the answer. Zero. Absolutely none." That's right. To continue to quote McKibben, "If we're serious about preventing catastrophic warming, the new study shows we can't dig any new coal mines, drill any new fields, build any more pipelines, not a single one. We're done expanding the fossil fuel frontier. Our only hope is a swift, managed decline in the production of all carbon-based energy from the fields we've already put into production." The reason I point that out and the reason I use McKibben is because in the people that I'm reading and the climate scientists that I'm checking out, McKibben actually falls more on the conservative end. But the important point, and the point that McKibben makes throughout the article, is that we should be facing and we should be preparing to face the absolute worst. Because year after year after year, each new study that comes out is worse than the one that came out before it. So when there's a new study that comes out next month that says, you know what, we studied these numbers for 2 decades, and my God, it's just this much worse than we thought it was going to be, that has been the trend for 25 years of climate science. So McKibben's point, my point, people like Guy McPherson's point, people like Derek Jensen who are making this point as well, is that we should be preparing for the absolute worst, and we should be resisting as though our lives depend on it. Now, to end this section on climate, I want to quote Ann and Paul Ehrlich. These are great biologists from Australia. I've had the chance of meeting. They've been doing great work for many, many decades now. And the point they're making, again, highlights part of what I mentioned earlier, and that's that our generation of activists, this new generation of people who are coming up, are facing a context that is in many ways quite unprecedented. So according to the ELRICS, Australian Biologies, this in the peer-reviewed journal Proceedings of a Royal Society, quote, virtually every past civilization has eventually undergone collapse, a loss of socio-political economic complexity usually accompanied by a dramatic decline in population size. Some, such as civilizations in Egypt and China, have recovered from collapses at various stages. Others, such as that of the Easter Island or the classic Maya, were apparently permanent. All those previous collapses were local or regional. Somewhere elsewhere, other societies and civilizations persisted unaffected. Sometimes, as in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, new civilizations arose in succession. In many, if not most cases, overexploitation of the environment was one proximate or ultimate cause of collapse. But today, for the first time in humanity's history, human global civilization, the worldwide, increasingly interconnected, highly technological society in which we are all one degree or another embedded, is threatened with collapse by an array of environmental problems. The reason I end with that quote is because today people are focusing on climate change. And yes, as others have argued, climate change may very well pose the most significant existential threat. But it is not just climate change. And it is not just making a transition to green technology. And this is where we get into talking about activism. This is where we get into talking about what is it exactly that we should do. Because when we talk about switching from a fossil fuel-based industry to a green technology, or however people want to say this, renewable energy systems, here I would quote my friend Derek, who would say, any way of life based on the use of non-renewable energy is doomed to failure. That much is pretty obvious to understand. But also, any way of life that is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable energy is also doomed to fail. So this idea that we're just going to live within a capitalist system, everything's going to be fine, we'll continue all these same structures and so on, but we'll just switch from using coal and natural gas and nuclear energy and petrol products to using solar and wind and so on is false. And I think many new people who are involved, including many of the younger environmental activists that I'm speaking with, I think really understand this. They want a more nuanced discussion about what that kind of a just transition would look like, how many resources can we use. As Kim and I have talked about in the past, what standard of living could what will be 9 billion people who are living on this planet by 2050 live at that would be sustainable? Because obviously, living in the United States, where we have 5% of the world's population, but we use 33% of the world's resources, isn't going to cut it. And it isn't going to cut it talking about the environment, just talking about climate change and not talking about deforestation, overfishing, the use of plastics, where we dump this material, production lines, supply chains, and so on. And we can go on down the list, rivers being polluted, waterways being polluted, so on and so forth. But the conversation, in my opinion, becomes much more interesting when we broaden it out. And we say, no, it's not just climate change. And no, it's not just running our economy on fossil fuels, because only what the numbers are, it's like 55 to 60% of the petrol that is extracted is used actually to run engines. The other 40 to 45% of the petrol that's extracted is used for different plastics. So your car, for instance, your car tires, everything that's in this room, this table, anything that's polyester, so on and so forth. So everything you look at in this room is a great example that's made out of a plastic material comes from that level of extraction. So it's not just so much, you know, people, and of course I agree, you want to abolish capitalism, that's fine. I'm for it. I was for it 10 years ago. I'm still for it. I also think part of the issue is industrialization. And if you speak with indigenous activists, and I've had a great opportunity to work with Aboriginal activists in Australia, I've had a great opportunity to work with Native American activists here, the biggest difference I can find from traditional leftists who come from a traditional left background, anarchist, communist, Marxist, socialist, and so on, is a completely different view in terms of the living world that I get from indigenous activists. And if you listen to the lectures, if you read the histories, if you look at the material that's being produced now from the activists in places like North Dakota or South Dakota, it is a different view of the natural world. It's not a natural world that can be managed, a natural world that can be sort of shifted to human needs, used when humans want it, discarded when humans want to, done when humans want to, protected when humans want to protect it. But it's looking at the natural world as a partner in our existence. And this gets much deeper than just, hey, how do we come up with some policies and some laws that can fix this? No, this is going to require people to radically change the ways in which they view themselves within this context and the ways in which they view the natural world. And one of the most important things we need to do is to talk about this idea of human supremacism, this idea that human beings are the most important species on this planet. Because everything that follows after that allows us, it's a justification for everything we want to do. If human beings are the most important people on the planet, well, anything we need to do to the rivers to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine. Anything we can do to the forest to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine too. This is some of the more important, I think, conversations, debates, and so on that we should be having if we're going to talk about ecology, if we're going to talk about living on a living planet in the future. And then, as I mentioned before, the question most of my friends are asking is not so much, it's interesting, I hear people talk about revolution, and again, that's great, I'm for it, I've been for it, I think we should be building movements that are capable of doing that. But within this context of collapse, a lot of the activists I'm speaking with as well, and a good friend of mine, Samantha Castro, is going to be in town from Australia next week. She heads the Friends of the Earth office in Melbourne, Australia, probably the most radical NGO that's out there, in my opinion, at least environmental NGO. A lot of the NGOs and the environmental side, so this is a great one in Australia. Part of what she's been talking about with a lot of the communities they're organizing with is how to brace for impact. Because I hear people talking like, we'll build the Green Party. And how long is that going to take? Oh, 10, 20 years. Oh, well, according to the data, in 20 years, we're not going to have fish in the ocean. So in 20 years, if Jill Stein or her predecessor or whatever, her successor, I'm sorry, becomes a viable candidate for president, that's great, but at the same time, we won't have fish in the ocean. So that means two things. That means either one, we build a movement big enough to do both, which means to build electoral capacity. We don't have the numbers for that. But to build the electoral capacity necessary to get people elected or to have a new political party while simultaneously having enough momentum and numbers to direct action, civil disobedience, protests, educational events, and so on. Of course, in my opinion, all of this should be part of one program, but we don't have the numbers for that. So when Samantha in Australia was asking me, what do you think about what's going on in North Dakota? I said, it's awesome. I mean, how could anyone in their right mind who's sitting in this room, you know, sort of poo-poo that and say, oh my, yeah, it's just nonsense or whatever. It's great. And we should use those lessons. We should use that information to help build new campaigns, coalitions, and so on. But it also is a sign of our limitations. That is quite literally where we are at. The ability to stop one segment of one small project. That is where we're at. We could stop the Keystone, and simultaneously there's 15 other pipelines that go in at the same time. We can stop North Dakota, but at the same time, Obama okayed offshore drilling in the Atlantic. They're going to drill in the Arctic and so on and so forth. Now, is this to bash all of the people who are involved? The answer is no. I give all of them, myself and everyone in this room, a ton of credit for staying involved, for being out there, for speaking out and being courageous. That's not the point. The point for me is, again, getting to the point of this conversation, is how can we build more effective movements? How can we take those lessons and expand them out? How can we build a movement that would be simultaneously capable of stopping a pipeline being put in North Dakota, but also run congressional candidates, but also be involved in, say, maybe more revolutionary behavior? Because, to be honest with you folks, and I say this as someone whose life has been virtually destroyed by violence, and I've seen violence destroy people's lives for the last 14 years of my life, since I was 18 years old. But I'm not a pacifist. I'm not a nonviolent dogmatist. In my opinion, as soon as I left the Marine Corps in 2006, I said, yeah, these people, they're willing to kill anybody in the world to get exactly what they want. And in order to stop entities like that, you know, am I prescribing martyrdom to people? No, but I'm sorry, in my lifetime, people are going to die. We're facing the most powerful entities in the world. These oil companies are willing to kill all of us. They have known about climate change for the last 40 years and used the same PR companies that the tobacco industry used to try and misinform people for the last 40 years. They don't care. So this idea that, oh, a few marches, a few votes, people will get arrested, my God, people might get beat up by the cops. Yeah, all that's already happening. My assumption is in the future we're going to need to build movements where people are willing to put their lives on the line, literally willing to put their lives on the line, to not only defend themselves and their communities, but to defend the planet. Now, that's not a prescription for a bunch of lunatics running around with AK-47s and so on. What that is, though, is a suggestion that anyone who's interested in building a resistance movement needs to talk about what that resistance movement actually looks like to combat the most powerful military, empire, industrial complex the world has ever seen. And obviously we know this. Someone like Martin Luther King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. This was 40 years ago, 45 years ago. In 45 years, it's become only that much more brutal, that much more violent, and that much more powerful in some ways. So, you know, some people think that that's really depressing. I don't. I mean, honestly, a lot of us, you know, we've come to this conclusion a long time ago. I mean, a lot of us, I think, are looking at the situation saying, okay, we can continue to do what we're doing and resist and pat each other on the back and go to these events and set up fundraisers and so on, and we could all just make ourselves feel good until it's over with. Or we can take a step back, look at what we're doing, and come to the conclusion that it's not working. We've had an environmental movement for 45 years in this country. 45 years since the beginning of the environmental movement in this country, and I'm sorry, folks, every single ecological indicator is worse today than it was 45 years ago. We've had the beginnings of a vibrant anti-war movement 45 years ago. And I'm sorry, folks, but the empire is that much bigger than it has ever been. That, again, isn't to just, hey, well, that's it, let's go home. In my thinking, what I'm interested to do, why I'm here today, why Robert asked me to come here, is to have a conversation about why that is, number one, and number two, what could we do to fix that? And if there is no, again, I'm not trying to say there's a solution, that there's easy answers. I'm looking for suggestions from people. I think we should all be looking for suggestions from one another. And I think we should also be really nice to one another, because I spent 2.5 years when I did a radio podcast out of Michigan City, Indiana, interviewing all of my heroes for many, many years. It was like, I have a radio show, my God, how can I start talking to people like Chomsky or Judith Butler or Cornel West or Vandana Shiva or go on down the list? And I'm here to tell you, folks, I don't know if you read all these people's work or pay attention to them. They also don't have many answers. There's a ton of analysis going on the left right now. If you look at Truth Out, you look at Common Dreams, you look at Counterpunch, you look at Zenit, Black Agenda Report, go down the list. Tons of excellent analysis. Excellent. But in terms of what can we do, what should we do, suggestions for resistance, ideas about the future, visions for what another society would look like, the kind of values we want to base that society on, or what the political program would look like to get to that kind of a society, those conversations are lacking. In fact, they're utterly missing. There's people simply going through the routine saying, hey, we can conduct single-issue campaigns, we can do civil disobedience, we can stop X, Y, or Z projects. But in terms of coming up with a coherent political platform that can be expressed not only through these acts of civil disobedience and single-issue campaigns, but also in an electoral sphere, in an educational context, and so on, that really doesn't exist. And there's a ton of people out there who are going to tell you how bad things are, but we don't have many people out there, and I'm encouraging anyone who's going to watch this, anyone who's going to listen to this, that we need more people writing about what they want. We need more discussions about what it is people want and what to do. Because, as I mentioned before, most average people, I think they're ahead of the curve. I think they're ahead of where average leftists give them credit for. I could talk to my neighbors, and they're not reading Chomsky or Bill McKibben's reports or whatever, and I talk to my neighbors, and they're like, Vince, we're So it's not convincing them, oh, your life's bad. No, they know. They're making $7.25 an hour. They don't have health insurance. Their lives are no prospects for the future. They know the environment's getting screwed up. So it's not me sitting there trying to convince my neighbors or people we're knocking on their doors for campaigns that, hey, you know, things are pretty bad. They're looking at me saying, no, tell me something I don't know. And then we say, well, you know, you can get involved with a movement. And then the next response is, well, what good is that going to do? That's up to us. I mean, we have to create the kind of movements and the kind of spaces that people want to come to. It's not going to be, hey, we'll put out the best analysis possible and maybe they'll read it, maybe they won't. And if they don't read it, that's their own fault. They're just another brain-dead, stupid-ass American, and what can we expect from them anyway? No. Nowhere else does that happen. I mean, what I see on the left is sort of a lack of introspection, a lack of reflective capacity. You know, people really don't, it's really hard, and I understand this, because my friends who are full-time organizers, I don't consider myself an organizer, I consider myself an activist. My friends who are organizers, day in, day out, knocking on doors, phone calls, fundraisers, sitting down, meetings, compromises, talking to people they don't want to talk to. I can't do it. I don't have the patience for it. But I pay attention to the people who are doing it, because those are often the people who have really good ideas about what it means to organize, their lessons from organizing, what's working, what's not working. And what they're telling me, from the MTO to the Fight for 15 to the environmental movement to Black Lives Matter, number one, sectarianism is a problem. Number two, identity politics and self-affirmation are a problem. Number three, living in a leftist bubble is a problem. Number four, personalities have been a problem. Number five, and this is getting, I think, to more substantive conversations, a lack of vision, as I mentioned earlier, and also a lack of reflection and an inability to self-critique. When you put all of your energy and effort into a campaign, it's hard to sit back 6 months later and go, you know what, it really wasn't that good. That's tough for anybody here who's done that. For anybody here who's tried to run, not only, I'm not talking about electoral campaigns here, I'm talking about single issue campaigns, like we want to stop this pipeline. If that doesn't work after 6 to 12 months, it's very hard for those organizers and activists to sit back and then say, you know what we were doing, the approach we took, the methods we used, they didn't work. Now how do we get better from this? And having those conversations openly and honestly in public venues such as today, I think personally, is the only way people are going to learn how we can build these movements for the future. So without rambling anymore, because I know it's 4 o'clock, I'm going to leave it there, and I'd rather open it up for Q&A. Thank you.
Vincent Emmanuel, speaking in Chicago, September 24, 2016. Our thanks to Dale Lehman of WZRD, who made the original recording, which I have slightly edited and condensed. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to more insightful commentary from a progressive perspective, check out the archive of our shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, asking, if not you, who? Reminding you that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear a speaker from the May 2016 Left Forum panel, a group of us organized, called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. And before getting into this, for those of you who don't understand what a Global Gladio Agenda means, it refers to the NATO-CIA-run Operation Gladio that terrorized Europe from the 1950s through the 1980s. I'm going to read from an article called 53 Admitted False Flag Attacks from Washington's blog posted in February of 2015 to explain Operation Gladio. And here goes. There are many documented false flag attacks where a government carries out a terror attack and then falsely blames its enemy for political purposes. And then later in the article, it goes on to say, the former Italian prime minister, an Italian judge, and the former head of Italian counterintelligence admit that NATO, with the help of the Pentagon and CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries in the 1950s and blame the communists in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe in their fight against communism. As one participant in this formerly secret program stated, quote, you had to attack civilians, people, women, children, innocent people, unknown people far removed from any political game. The reason was quite simple. They were supposed to force these people, the Italian public, to turn to the state to ask for greater security. They also allegedly carried out terror attacks in France, Belgium, Denmark, Germany, Greece, the Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, and UK, and other countries. False flag attacks carried out pursuant to this program include, by way of example only, the murder of the Turkish prime minister in 1960, bombings in Portugal in 1966, the Piazza Fontana massacre in Italy in 1969, terror attacks in Turkey in 1971, the Peteano bombing in Italy in 1972, shootings in Brescia, Italy, and a bombing on an Italian train, 1974, shootings in Istanbul, Turkey, 1977, the Atocha massacre in Madrid, Spain, 1977, the abduction and murder of the Italian prime minister, 1978, the bombing of the Bologna railway station in Italy, 1980, and shooting and killing 28 shoppers in Brabant County, Belgium, in 1985. If you want more information on Operation Gladio, you can do an online search for articles, books, and videos. There's a lot out there on it. Believe me, I'm not making it up. And if you've been paying attention, you also know that 9/11 was a false flag event, falsely blamed on Muslims, used to justify all of the wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan. But now let's get back to the Left Forum, and the speaker you're going to hear today is Richard Dolan. I want to apologize in advance for some of the sound quality. This was taped live, so some of the imperfections were unavoidable. This segment starts out with me introducing Richard Dolan. So here goes.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming out. This is our fifth panel on the deep state, and it is called False Flags: How the United Left Could Defeat a Global Gladio Agenda. Just let me give you the definition of the deep state: is an unelected, unaccountable, militarized corporate security state unaffected by public opinion or elections and beyond the law's reach. We are really fortunate today to have a great panel here with us. It's an honor to be up here with them. They're going to be talking about false flags, as you know, and a false flag are what our deep state does to move their agenda forward and get the public to go along with the horrendous things that they do. We're going to start with Richard Dolan. Richard Dolan is an author, an historian. His soon-to-be-published book, A History of False Flag Operations, details how clandestine agencies secretly engage in violence and destruction in order to promote their agendas. He has published four prior books and numerous articles on anomalous phenomena: suppressed science, secret space programs, breakaway civilizations, the intelligence community, and similar subjects. He's best known as the author of two volumes of history, UFOs and the National Security State. He studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. So if you please welcome Richard Dolan.
Thank you. Appreciate the welcome. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for inviting me. Yes, I write books about the fringe. I've been doing that for a couple of decades and been the most fascinating journey of my life. I've been focusing now on false flag phenomena operations for the past year and a half. I am in the process of completing a book, hopefully before this year is out. So I guess what I would start is saying, when we look around in our society, I think it's not just those of us here who are very awake and very alert to what's happening in the world around us, but those in our family, friends, people who are not even as focused on zeroing in on the problems of this world. In my town, I live in Rochester, New York. I've seen the evaporation of Eastman Kodak in the last 20 years. It just goes poof. And you see this sense of helplessness that is really pervasive in our society. I believe, you know, in earlier years, I might have thought, well, that's just how things are. But I think this is actually by design. I think that a sense of helplessness is being imposed upon us for very specific reasons. And reason number one is that we're witnessing a theft of our planet. It's happening before our very eyes. We now know the wealthiest 80 people in the world have as much wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. The 80 wealthy, no, it's actually 60. Pardon me, that number has been recently revised. The top 60 wealthiest individuals on planet Earth have as much accumulated wealth as the entire bottom half of humanity. So when you have a situation like that, and when these people, are, of course, are ensconced in the transnational corporations that dominate everything, that's theft, that's a war. If you have a war like this, the necessary thing for them to do is to rule by or war you by indirection and deception. Because what they don't want us to know is that this whole thing is happening, because then we would maybe have something to do about it. So they require compliance, first and foremost, and they require distraction and deception. Now, a false flag, the way that I've been looking at it lately, is one form, really the nastiest form, but one form of a kind of spectrum of propaganda that is used against us. All right. Some of these forms of propaganda are much more, I don't want to say benign, but much less intense. You know, we start off with the inculcation of just basic cultural values. We go to elementary school and we place our hand over our heart and we pledge allegiance to the flag, and that makes us good citizens. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want a certain level of cultural consensus, but it starts the process of working with the system, be a team player. The next level of control or propaganda is a little bit more nasty. And that's, I guess, what we would call the cultural distractions, the Kardashians, you know, dancing with whatever they got on this week, Monday Night Football. And all of this that basically says to us, look over here at this pretty little thing. Don't look over here at the theft that's going on before your eyes. Have fun. Dance with the stars. And so it's increasingly, as we all can see this, an immersive culture that it's a form of brainwashing and distraction. Clearly. Now, there are always those people in our society who want to feel like they're being informed, and so they'll turn on the TV and watch CNN, in which they will then become permanently, forever distracted and confused. And again, this is by design. I used to, you know, I travel a lot, and it's really true. Like in every single airport gate in the country, virtually every airport gate in the country, if you look at the TV screen, you see CNN. And why is this? Is it really a case of every airport manager says, oh, I really love CNN. I want to inform the public? Not really. What it is they have a private corporation owned by Time Warner that's cut a great deal with the government, and they're able to do it because they are the propaganda voice of the U.S. State Department and CIA. That is what CNN is. So people will turn on the TV, they'll watch CNN, or they'll turn on their establishment news media. And there was a study done, I think, a little over 25 years ago, around the time of the Persian Gulf War. It was during that time. I think out of the University of Colorado. And basically the study was, it's like, oh, my God, shock. The more television news people watched, the less they knew about basic geographical facts, like where is Israel on the map? Where is Syria? Where is Russia? And they thought, well, this is a great failing of our news media, but really this is a great success of our television and news culture. Right? Really, the purpose isn't to inform, it's really to pull you in for advertising and to distract you. So the whole CNN phenomenon, the MSNBC or Fox or NPR, it really doesn't matter. It literally does not matter. So that whole purpose is to exist within a very narrowly defined spectrum of what is permissible social discourse. And within those boundaries, you must remain. Beyond those boundaries, do not dare to go, or else become shamed and you're out of the discussion. So I would say that those three levels of propaganda probably account for 95% of all of the mind control that exists in our society. And it works very well. But then you have an occasional necessity, let us say, in the minds of those who are wanting to handle us, for stronger measures. And this is when we get into various types of covert operations, whether it's color revolution, regime change, other types of what I'd like to call shock doctrine, opportunism, after the excellent book by Naomi Klein, and then into false flags. So I'll just talk a little bit about those. So again, I look at these all as a spectrum. And it seems to me it's helpful for us to see how false flags fit into this spectrum. And by the way, what I will then conclude with is, because I don't really want to get into the specific false flags. These gentlemen will talk about some of them. There's probably 100. In the book that I'm working on, I think I've identified probably about 100 or so likely false flag events that have shaped our world in the last century. But what I'm more interested in going over here with you today is simply giving a kind of, at least my analytical framework and why I think that this is something that we really need to understand. But when we get into color revolutions, a stronger medicine, as it were, to control us and corral us, these are things really that get into an argument with your relatives or with some debunker or skeptic on the news bulletin boards. One thing you can tell them is that false flags are in the U.S. Army Psychological Operations Manual. It's right in there. It's in the book. What they now call psychological operations, they don't call them PSYOPs anymore. They call them Military Information Support Operations, or MISO, MISO. So in this manual, they define white, gray, and black operation, black PSYOPs. So white PSYOPs are pretty straightforward. It's basically the U.S. State Department putting out a statement on behalf of the United States government. You know where it's coming from. They're obviously spinning their information, but it's fairly straightforward. That's a white PSYOP. Gray PSYOP is a little different. If you know, many of us are familiar with Operation Mockingbird, that was a gray PSYOP. So it was a situation in which you have proxies in the media basically doing your speaking for you. It's a great thing. If you're doing public speaking and you seed the audience with your cohorts who then pitch you softball questions and make you look smart, that would be a gray PSYOP, I guess you could say. In the U.S. military's formulation of it, a gray PSYOP would be statements by other sources, presumably media sources or NGOs would also be one, that would actually be providing your perspective on things. But it makes it look much more impressive because it's not you saying it, so that's a gray PSYOP. And that was Operation Mockingbird, which Carl Bernstein outed back in 1977, in which we learned that there were at least, I think this is very understated, 400 paid U.S. journalists on the CIA payroll back then. Of course, as we know, the CIA then said, oh, no, we don't do that arrangement with journalists anymore. Very legalistic terminology if you really hear the CIA talk like this. Obviously, what we have today is a situation so vastly beyond anything that ever existed in the Mockingbird days. It's beyond the pale. Because it's not just the CIA, it's the military, it's the Pentagon, which spends $4 billion every year on managing its social media. So they're taking your money and my money and then using it to mind job you and propagandize you. Oh, that's great. Thank you. So that's a great PSYOP. Now, black PSYOP is, and actually, I wish I had the quote in front of me. It's okay. A black PSYOP in their manual is literally a situation in which agents or actors who are part of the U.S. system create an act that is then attributed to another party. It could be another country or another party. That is literally a false flag. One of the interesting things they say in this manual is that that type of activity is not something that military personnel do, that this is the reserve of intelligence, whether it's military intelligence, Army, Navy intelligence, Air Force intelligence, or CIA or some other intelligence group, but not the military. And again, this is explicitly stated in the current U.S. Military Psychological Operations Manual. I think it's rather interesting. So again, if you're in a debate with your friends or adversaries, this is part of the playbook. But there's a spectrum, as I said before. So one thing that the United States has mastered the art of is the color revolution kind of protocol. And many of us are familiar with what happened in Iran in 1953. Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of TR, helps to organize Operation Ajax, in which Mossadegh is taken out, God forbid, because he really took shell oil out of Iran and can't do that. So he's got to go. Well, after the fall of the Soviet Union, we have the perfection of the so-called peaceful revolutions, they call them the color revolutions. Georgia in 03 had the Rose Revolution, Ukraine in 04 had the Orange Revolution, and so on. These are supposedly people-generated movements to get rid of authoritarian governments, which then inevitably become very, very pro-Western, pro-corporate, just so happens. Well, this is, again, by design. So we know that these are promoted and funded with billionaire money. George Soros, very much involved in this whole thing. Koch brothers are doing this right now in Brazil against Dilma Rousseff. Same type of protocol. So you have a situation in which money goes into these countries, destabilizes them, finds a wedge by which to open up the society, particularly getting young people to get worked up over a particular issue. It's easy to do. And you get them to the streets, and boom, next thing you know, you're inciting revolution. And sometimes, if you're the CIA, you'll have your snipers on the rooftops, like in Ukraine, killing people and attributing it to the government. So that's the color revolution protocol. And what's amazing about it is the U.S. has become so good at this. There's no one in the world can do what the U.S. does in this regard. I'm going to talk about why in like about 1 minute. Beyond color revolutions and provocations, agent provocateurs and crowds and so forth, inciting violence. This is an old story, of course. It goes on to this day. And in fact, it's spread more and more. It's global. The real difficulty in separating false flags, let me phrase it this way. There's one difficulty in identifying a false flag, and that is distinguishing it from what I call the shock doctrine opportunism. So Naomi Klein's excellent book, Shock Doctrine, and she has a very important insight. She's talking about how the U.S. runs the world militarily by shock and awe, which is really one of the most incredible expressions. Think about this. Your own government's like shocking and awing other countries. Well, she had the insight that this is not simply how we rule militarily, but how we rule at home, through trauma, through shock. So she talked about Katrina. She talked about 9/11. And she wasn't talking about them as false flags, but she was talking about them as traumatic events in which people are bereft. They're kind of on their back psychologically, and they're looking to the government for help. And it's at that moment she points out that these plans roll out, corporate takeover of New Orleans after Katrina, national security protocols after 9/11, the whole USA Patriot Act fascist takeover. So all of these are, I guess she would see, I don't want to misquote her, but as a kind of evil opportunism. I think this is exactly very much part of our world. But I would say there are instances in which agencies go a step further and they make these things happen, and that's a false flag. And distinguishing between opportunism and false flag, I would have to say, is probably not always going to be easy. And maybe it's not always even necessary. Because I think we're getting to a point in our world where, you know, if you really know how to ride that horse known as the public, you know when things are going to happen. And sometimes it's in your interest just to let them happen, or maybe just nudge them a little bit. So we're getting into a very, very sophisticated kind of gray area here. These handlers are very good at what they do. The reason that we have false flags permeating our world today, you know, there are people, you go on the web and they'll talk about false flags as an ancient phenomenon. And when I started looking into this, I was inclined to accept that. I don't believe that anymore. I think false flags are a distinctively modern phenomenon. There may be some ancient false flags, but they're the outliers, not the rule. Nero burning down Rome, I actually doubt it. I don't think that's what happened, blaming it on the Christians. But even if it is, it's an exception to the rule. Basically, false flags, with a few exceptions, begin in earnest after the First World War. And the reason for this is very simple. The world is militarized after the First World War, so we actually now have covert op teams that exist, which didn't exist before, at least sophisticated ones. Secondarily, we have the now birth, really, of the modern media propaganda system. And this is an absolute necessity. And we have this situation after the First World War in which certain governments particularly dominated their national media. We're talking Germany, Japan, Soviet Union, which really initiated the first real true false flags of our era in the 1930s. Don't need to get into them. They're mostly international, other than the Reichstag, the Manchuria's false flag, invasion of Poland, obviously, invasion of Finland was a false flag by the Soviets. These are international. They were really early types of false flags in our modern era. What we see after the Second World War is a transformation of this phenomenon. It becomes much more domestic. So the tools are being used against populations. And in the false flag Olympics after the Second World War, the United States runs away with the gold medal. There's no question about it. And the reason for this, and I'm now going to jump ahead and wrap up why this is conceptually really so important. False flags, we had Gladio in the 50s, we had COINTELPRO, we had a lot of other things. We had the U.S. and the British funding the Muslim Brotherhood in the 1950s to take down Nasser in Egypt. They didn't like the fact that you had this independent Egyptian leader who was not going to be part of any of the blocs. And they said, well, he's got to go. So they funded the head-chopping jihadists back then. Well, it didn't work against Nasser. But hey, why stop a good thing? And they just kept it going. And they do that to this day, clearly. But the reason false flags are necessary from their point of view today is twofold. Let's go back to Seattle in 1999, all right, the WTO protests. And you have a situation in which an entire middle class of a nation is being disemboweled, which is really what we've got. When people believe they have rights, they're really not going to take that lying down. They'll protest, as they did in Seattle, when more than 40,000 people shut that entire city down. And the WTO protests, they literally prevented delegates from entering the building. Tear gas didn't work. Pepper spray didn't work. This is an unmanageable situation from the point of view of those people at the very top of our food chain. This is 18, 19 months before 9/11. So what 9/11 meant is that the hammer came down on us, beat us over the head with a big national security stick, and away goes this idea of people protest. Now, if you protest, which many of us here do, we know you're photographed, you're in a database. It's an act of intimidation at the very least and coercion at the most. And this has now become the norm. So globalization, neoliberalist, transcorporate domination agenda, this is one of the key pillars of why false flags are necessary. There needs to be a pretext to intimidate the population. The other pillar, why false flags are necessary today, is, I would say, is the petrodollar system, which is really the foundation of the U.S. empire internationally. You know, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 1971 simply because the Vietnam War caused us to crank out the dollars. The U.S. was hinged to gold. The dollar suddenly was not really reflecting the price of gold accurately. Nations realized this. We started hemorrhaging gold out of Fort Knox because the dollar was really overvalued. And Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard temporarily, by which he meant permanently, and that saved the gold problem. It did not save the dollar problem. There is the danger of all these dollars coming back. There's really no intrinsic reason for nations to hold on to the dollar if there's no U.S. dollar gold standard. Enter Henry Kissinger 2 years later, makes a deal with Saudi Arabia, says, we will support your evil, tyrannical 9th century regime forever, give you all the weapons you want, as long as you sell all your oil in dollars, accepting no other currency. Saudis are cool with that. All the other OPEC nations go on board, and the U.S. is back on easy street. And the necessity, it's a horrible crime that Americans are not educated in this fundamental fact. Almost every important feature of American foreign policy has some relation to a dollar. It must be maintained. And when the threats come to the system, such as Saddam Hussein in 2000, start selling his oil in euros, that can't happen. So we create the fictitious weapons of mass destruction charade. Muammar Gaddafi, a few years later, is about to introduce a gold-based dinar. Cannot happen. You create fictions about carpet bombing your population during the Arab Spring and so forth, and you have them killed. And, you know, they wanted to do the same thing with Syria, which wasn't a direct threat to the petrodollar system, but geopolitically is allied with those groups that do threaten the petrodollar system and has to be taken down as well. So I think what we're seeing is, as long as this situation is in place, and the other reasons we have to have false flags from their point of view is we have a situation in which we've got international law, which says wars are wrong after the First World War, and a situation in which nations are ostensibly democratic. And I say ostensibly. Almost every nation in the world now is ostensibly democratic, with very few exceptions. And so what that means is governments have to have the pretext of rule by the people. And this is why they need to corral public opinion the way that they do. All right, so it's when an international law says, now law, war is wrong, you can't have wars of aggression and so forth. So you've got to create these pretexts. False flags are the ultimate tool in the propaganda toolkit for this. We're now in an era post 9/11 in which, you know, when you're creating a kind of global police state, and this is exactly what we're seeing, of course, you have to go by degree, step by step by step by step by step to intimidate and modify the behavior of entire populations. So each successive false flag that we see, or each successful form of manipulation we see, they're not all on the order of 9/11, of course. They don't have to be. They can be smaller false flags, but each one is, it's like a specialized weapon designed for a specialized goal and agenda. You know, in the case of the Boston Marathon bombing, which, yes, absolutely. I think the primary focus of that was to roll out the militarized police. That is now a ubiquitous fact of American life, in which you have 19,000 militarized police breaking into the homes of Boston residents as if there's no big deal. Well, we've gone through all that now. That's part of what we are. But some of the mass shootings, sure, there's undoubtedly gun control motivations in it, but there's also psychological profiling motivations in there. Sandy Hook is a perfect case in point, where you have legislation coming out to now, oh, let's create psychological profile screening of the population, mental health, and so forth. Last thing I'll just say is, how do we identify these? What we're seeing is almost like a Cold War, a psychological Cold War going on between the deep state and us. All right. So as we learn more, they adapt. So one of the things that you see with these false flags, when you see a major, horrific, traumatic event happen and an immediate media focus to identify the culprit, in which within days everything seems to be all figured out, we really have to be very suspicious. It doesn't prove that it's a false flag. The only thing that proves a false flag is good independent journalism and investigation. But there are profiles of these. The existence of the multiple drills often is the case. I don't know if that will continue indefinitely because I think people are onto this. But you had it with 9/11. You had it with London, the two bombings, 7/7/05. You had it with some of the shootings, Aurora, Colorado, and I believe San Bernardino, and there are others in Paris as well. You have these drills going on. And what's the point of these drills? Like drills to protect against the exact event that happens. What a coincidence. Well, I think the reason for this has happened many times, very deeply suspicious. Well, reason number one is that, you know, it's helpful in providing confusion to the day to impede proper response to the event itself. But I think the real reason is deeper in the planning stages. If I'm working on a false flag and you're in the intelligence community and you're my colleague and you're not on the on the inside of it, but you learn about this somehow in advance of it, I can simply say to you, no, no, we're doing a drill. So it would really disable an independent investigation within in the intelligence group. And I think that's actually an important part of it. But the thing is, we're learning these tricks, and now I think that we're going to see adaptations in the future. I think moving forward, we have to look for more adaptations and variations in false flags. They're not all simply going to be military events. They're not all simply going to be shootings and bombings. They're corporate. They are a variety of forms of psychological manipulation, often in a very subtle, sophisticated way. And, you know, we've moved a long, long way from the actual false flags of the pirate days. Would that we were as honorable as the pirates. You know, and when they would give you a false flag, they would literally raise the flag of another country, Britain or Netherlands, and then you'd come up to them. But then they would raise the black flag, and you know it's pirates robbing your ship. At least they had that much of a sense of honor. We're so far removed from that. The last thing I would just say is we're reminded of Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of freedom. And this is true. What we have to do is not despair. We have to just wake up ourselves, wake up other people around us, and be brave. I believe that it is absolutely possible for us on an individual basis and on a social basis to organize and to fight this. It's really the only choice we have. We're moving into a global society. The real question is it going to look like freedom or is it going to look like fascism? And I think we want it to look like freedom. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to a presentation given by author Richard Dolan at the May 2016 Left Forum in New York City. The full video of the false flag panel he was part of is posted on YouTube. I encourage you to check it out. And now to close out the show, I'm going to read a few more of these false flag attacks from the Article 58 admitted false flag attacks. So here goes. Japanese troops set off a small explosion on a train track in 1931 and falsely blamed it on China in order to justify an invasion of Manchuria. A major with the Nazi SS admitted at the Nuremberg trials that under orders from the chief of the Gestapo, he and some other Nazi operatives faked attacks on their own people and resources, which they blamed on the Poles to justify an invasion of Poland. The British Prime Minister admitted to his defense secretary that he and American President Dwight Eisenhower approved a plan in 1957 to carry out attacks in Syria and blame it on the Syrian government as a way to effect regime change. The NSA admitted that it lied about what really happened in the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, manipulating data to make it look like North Vietnamese boats fired on a U.S. ship so as to create a false justification for the Vietnam War. A U.S. congressional committee admitted that as part of its COINTELPRO campaign, the FBI had used many provocateurs in the 1950s through 70s to carry out violent acts and falsely blame them on political activists. Senior police officials in Genoa, Italy admitted that in July 2001 at the G8 summit in Genoa, it planted two Molotov cocktails and faked the stabbing of a police officer in order to justify a violent crackdown against protesters. Although the FBI now admits that the 2001 anthrax attacks were carried out by one or more U.S. government scientists, a senior FBI official says that the FBI was actually told to blame the anthrax attacks on Al-Qaeda by White House officials. A former U.S. intelligence officer recently alleged, "Most terrorists are false flag terrorists or are created by our own security services." The head and special agent in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles office said that most terror attacks are committed by the CIA and FBI as false flags. So don't be duped. Whenever there's a new terrorist attack, please make sure you do your homework before you believe what the government and media are telling you. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Driscoll's Harvest of Shame, the stories of the farm workers in San Quintin, Mexico, and Sagamon County, Washington State, and why they say boycott Driscoll Foods.
Now, as far as Nevada's unions are concerned, hotel mogul turned Republican president-elect Donald Trump should put his money where his mouth is and pay his hotel workers in Las Vegas fair and living wages and recognize their union, too.
The 500-plus workers who seek to join the hotel employees and restaurant employees Local 226 are battling Trump management over union recognition, wages, and working conditions. They say that the hotel management breaking labor law, including by verbal threats and physical assaults.
They are breaking law, for sure. Bethany Kahn, Director of Communications of the Culinary Workers Union, Local 226, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us the story of our sisters and brothers at the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas.
So after 500 workers, over a majority of the workers voted to unionize in December of 2015, Mr. Trump and his company have objected and fought the unionization efforts. And on November 3rd, just days before Election Day, the National Labor Relations Board issued a decision and order essentially saying that Mr. Trump and his company have to negotiate, they're legally required to negotiate, and they should stop breaking federal law. So that's where we are right now, and we'll continue to organize and litigate to compel Mr. Trump and his company to negotiate a contract. The workers are fighting for fair wages, job security, good health benefits, and Mr. Trump, who's the president-elect, his company pays his employees $3 less than other union workers in Las Vegas.
If you could just put a human face on who are these workers so we get a sense of what their lives are like and what it means by getting paid $3 less than the other unions there. And you can also talk about the threats if you want to, because that was pretty significant.
Yeah. So mostly women of color, immigrants, largely Latina workers that work at the Trump Hotel Las Vegas, and they're living paycheck to paycheck. Talk to workers who are housekeepers, who are surviving breast cancer, or trying to put their kids through college or school, and they're having a really hard time doing that because they don't have access to the middle class right now, and that's what they voted on, right? They voted to unionize so they would have a strong union contract, which would provide for fair wages and good health insurance. Culinary union members comprise a majority of the middle class here in Nevada, and that's something that we're very proud to continue fighting for over 80 years. And these workers at Trump Hotel Las Vegas are the latest to join and stand up and say, we deserve better, and we want a contract, and we want a union. And all Mr. Trump needs to do is set an example. He's going to be the president of the United States of America. He needs to set an example and negotiate a contract.
In the run-up to the union election, which the union obviously won, although Trump doesn't want to recognize that at this point, what kind of tactics did his company take against the workers to try to persuade them not to join the union?
Mr. Trump's company spent $500,000 on an anti-union busting company. They brought the company in to hold captive audience meetings and intimidate and harass the workers and really create a hostile work environment. And it's within that environment a vote happened, and still a majority of workers voted to unionize, and it's a higher majority than what Mr. Trump has won in the Electoral College, a higher percentage. And they voted because they deserve better and they want a contract. We're never going to stop fighting, and every day we're going to get stronger. There's going to be protests and rallies. And actually, the Culinary Union has called for a national boycott of hotels and golf courses and businesses that do business with Mr. Trump.
Well, we're going to get back to that in a moment, but I remember reading one of the statements of Maria Jaramillo, who's a housekeeper at the Trump Las Vegas, who told the union, "This country is a nation of immigrants, and we all work hard and deserve to be treated fairly." Now, you a moment ago began to give a human face to people like Maria, these here in a 55,000-member strong local. What do their jobs look like? What are the kind of jobs that they actually do, that they're fighting so hard for a better wage benefit and, of course, for union representation?
We represent over 500 workers at Trump Hotel Las Vegas, and they're cooks, bartenders, cocktail servers, food servers, housekeepers, everybody who makes that hotel run. And everyone, all of those workers make the hospitality industry here in Las Vegas run. And so they're people who have, if you have a union job, have a good middle-class life. And that's what these workers who are surrounded by union properties, they want that too. And they just really want an opportunity to provide for their families. And that's why they're fighting, and they're fighting every day against their boss, who's going to be the next president of the United States of America.
And of course, that would be health benefits too.
Yes, and health benefits are really important for their families and their kids. Culinary union members pay $0 and have zero monthly premium for health care. And so that's a really important part of the contract and part of, you know, becoming a union member, and that's what workers are fighting for.
So the election happened almost a year ago, right, in December of 2015, and Trump has refused to recognize the union. Now, the workers have gone to, the union has gone to the NLRB. What have they said about this?
The National Labor Relations Board, you know.
The National Labor Relations Board has consistently told Donald Trump and his company that the union election wasn't rigged and that he must sit down and negotiate with the culinary union. And so Mr. Trump is breaking federal law, and Trump Hotel Las Vegas is operating illegally. We think that Mr. Trump should accept the federal government's order to negotiate, and he should treat his workers with respect.
And Bethany, where does it go from here if he continues to be so recalcitrant? It's wonderful the way he uses the term rigged, and it's rigged when it's not in his favor,
right.
And it's not rigged when, we got it. So what's the next step for the workers if he, as I said, continues to remain so recalcitrant? And then, of course, tell us again about the nationwide boycott to put pressure on Donald Trump for a fair contract, a decent wage, and unionization of our sisters and brother workers at the Trump Las Vegas.
So if folks are interested in learning more about the boycott, go to vegastravelalert.org/Trump, and you'll see the national actions that have been happening from L.A. to Hawaii, Chicago, D.C. There have been protests and picket lines all by Unite Here and the AFL-CIO and the Culinary Union. And so we're going to keep up that fight, and we'll continue to keep up picketing and protesting, but also litigate and compel Mr. Trump and his company to negotiate. Right now, the hotel is operating illegally, and because any of those changes that they make to employment or grievances, any of that stuff needs to be negotiated with the culinary union, and so they are liable for it, and we will hold them accountable, and we're not going to stop fighting. The culinary union has been fighting for workers for over 80 years, and we've fought against billionaires before. We fought against multi-million dollar corporations, and we're not going to stop. And we will continue to hold the boss accountable, even if the boss is the President of the United States of America.
And Trump has appealed the decision of the NLRB, National Relations Board, to federal court. What does that mean?
We're confident that any further appeals will get overruled or dismissed. In this practice of expensive litigation, the federal government and, you know, everyone who's looked at this case has overthrown or overturned or dismissed their objections or their claims. The election wasn't rigged. It was a fair election. It's time for Mr. Trump to negotiate. And so we're confident that the D.C. Circuit Court will rule again, or will rule in our favor.
Bethany Kahn, what support from community and other unions are our sisters and brothers from the Trump Las Vegas getting in Nevada?
We've gotten a lot of support from community members and allies in the city and also across the country. The AFL-CIO, our brothers and sisters from other unions and Unite Here have been on the picket lines and rallies with us. And we hear all the time on our social media, at Culinary226 on Twitter, Instagram, or on Facebook, that people support the workers in their fight, and they know we're not going to stop fighting, and we will win, and it's just a matter of time when Mr. Trump signs a contract, and so he should sit down and negotiate a contract.
Now, here's a difficult question for you. Bethany Kahn, Director of Communications of the Colony Workers Union, Local 226. What's your favorite slogan that the workers have been using when they're on the picket lines? Because we can pick it up here in the tri-state area and use it when we come across Mr. Trump.
Sure. I love hearing no contract, no peace.
No contract, no peace. Okay, that works. Come on, anything a little bit more lyrical there. I mean, that's good. That's good. It's kind of the baseline. Now that we've got the baseline, how about bringing in some trumpets? Anything else? No pun intended there.
I think we've said dumb Trump before.
Okay,
I'm not
dumb
sure.
Trump.
Yeah,
all right. You know, the standards work. The standards work. So as we wind up this segment again, what should people do along with their sisters and brothers down in Las Vegas to support our folks who work hard, who labor, who want a decent way of living? What do we do again to support them and to make sure that they get the equal treatment and are respected as they should be for all of their contributions as workers, and as workers in this case to the Trump Las Vegas Hotel? What do we do?
Folks should not patronize golf courses and hotels and businesses that do business with Mr. Trump until he negotiates, right, and with his workers here in Las Vegas. So that's one thing. The second thing is you can go on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook at Culinary226 or our website, VegasTravelAlert.org/Trump. And you can share things. You can tweet at us. You can tweet at Donald Trump. There's a lot of really active things happening on social media to support the workers. And so we'd love to see supporters and allies out there.
But what we're going to do is we're going to say boycott Trump. Trump Las Vegas Hotel must negotiate and unite with our sisters and brothers. Bethany Kahn, thank you so much for speaking with us. Bethany, again, is the Director of Communications of the Culinary Workers Union, Local 226. Well, now we shift to, you know, there are 70,000 farm workers in the Valley of San Quintin, Baja California, Mexico, that have been waging intermittent strikes, organizing roadblocks, and mass mobilizations since at least March 2015 to demand an increase in their daily wage from $7.50 per day and an 8-hour workday for health care, for overtime pay and vacation days, and an end to the widespread sexual abuse.
And they're seeking the legal recognition of their independent union as the bargaining agent for these 70,000 workers. These farm workers pick strawberries, tomatoes, and other fruit primarily for export to the U.S. under the label of Driscoll, although its Mexican subsidiary is Barry Max. Al Rojas, a founding member of the United Farm Workers and president of the Sacramento Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, and Eduardo Rosario, president of the New York City chapter of Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you both. But let's begin by describing the conditions in San Quintin, because I don't think people still, you know, since Edward R. Murrow did The Harvest of Shame, I really don't think we grasp what farm workers are going through. And why don't you set the stage for us, Al?
I want to start by saying history repeats itself and continues to repeat itself. We go back 50 years with the farm worker strike in Delano, 1965, and then it culminates with 3 years of striking and go nowhere and decide to go on a boycott as the only tool left for us to dream and hope about something that may benefit farm workers finally, historically. It did happen. And here we are, 50 years later, with the 70,000-80,000 out of San Quintin, 5 hours from the U.S.-Mexican border, or from Tijuana. The conditions are no different or worse. And all this is a culmination of very fertile area region in Baja California, north, with the issue of massive deportations with both Republican and Democratic administrations. But more so for the last 8 years of the Obama administration / Hillary, also administration, what you call, with almost 3 million people being deported, most of them now indigenous people from the states of Oaxaca, Guerrero, Michoacán, and Chiapas, which are the southernmost states where extreme poverty exists. That migration happens internally with the Mexican Republic, and many have ended up and have ended up now in San Quintin with the hopes of being able to cross the border. Many have. But in the last 8 years, the highest number of any administration has been the Obama administration. Went along that close to 500,000 to 600,000 children who are American-born children who have been forcibly sent back with their parents who were deported. So they're becoming basically undocumented in Mexican society. The result of it is obviously a cheap wage. And the whole idea of globalization of corporations such as Driscoll Corporation and other corporations who have now crossed the border as they have been since the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So what does that mean for workers in San Quintin? Well, when most growers are approached by the media, in this case, Berrymex, which is a subsidiary from the Driscoll Corporation, Joseph Ryder Corporation, based out of the Watsonville, California region with along the coast, a stronghold of agriculture with regards to also strawberry harvesting. So what this means is that here you have the same system where growers are paying a wage that barely subsists. And aside from that, supplementing children, because in most cases, agriculture works on the basis of a system of the piece rate system. Whatever you earn by container, by box, or by a gondola, or what you want to call the number of quality of what you can produce at the speed that you can produce, which the more speed, the more profit for, and the less labor cost for the employer, because generally it can only withstand no more than 6 hours. So in some cases, when they pay, like in San Quintin, a cheap wage of $7.50 or less, and sometimes not even get paid for it, or they pay cash without having to take the deductions. Now, in most cases, workers who live in those labor camps, they're kind of like show places where workers live in semi-decent places. But the mere fact that you have 80,000, 70,000 human beings end up living in squalid conditions in communities where they find a piece or a plot of land to build a house. If you go to San Quintin today, those workers live in basically pallets, reused pallets for siding, whatever lumber they can get a hold of, tin metal, and also plastic. Plastic tarping to cover the walls or the roofs.
Al Rojas, let me just stop you for one moment because I don't want to lose our brother Eduardo Rosario in this also. And maybe you can add your thoughts on some of the things that Al Rojas has been saying about the kinds of conditions that our brothers and sisters in San Quintin have been enduring.
the struggle and the conditions that these farm workers, these gallant men and women, and let's also be mindful there's an extensive use of child labor also happening here, clearly is an expression of the failures of the purported gains and successes that the neoliberal theory, that globalization was to give the world. This is clearly not the case. In fact, what has been used to give some backdrop, in addition to these conditions that help sustain such deplorable conditions, have been these protection contracts that were signed by the farm owners, the property owners, and government-controlled unions, the CTM, the CROM, the CROC, who are essentially government-run unions, where the contracts signed are nothing more than sweetheart deals favoring the growers. There have been articles in the mainstream media about the conditions of farm workers in San Quintin that describe rat-infested camps, some without toilets, with workers routinely having their wages illegally withheld, and many facing debt after being gouged by the overpricing of necessities sold at the company stores. And with so low pay, it amounts to less than one-tenth of what U.S.-based farm workers are earning. And in my opinion, and the opinion of many, farm workers in the United States are not paid properly. So when you go back to the weekend of... It was in May the 9th and 10th of 2015, last year, Baja California government, instead of opening negotiations with the farm workers, as they had promised, instead sent in the police and came down with iron fists, severely wounding, and opened fire with rubber bullets, some live ammunition, but you alluded to with the 70 workers that were injured and wounded. So and many of these workers were left in critical condition, seriously injured. The repression against the farm workers of San Quintin made front page news and created a huge backlash across Mexico. The growers are refusing to abide by the agreement between the Mexican government and the union. They're the workers. Because they're just basically saying, well, we have a contract, and that's what these government controlled unions, these heavy handed goon type unions.
So let's be clear. We are talking about now Berry Max is the subsidiary, the Mexican subsidiary of Driscoll. And Driscoll, as anybody here knows, if they've tried to get any kind of berries, any kind of strawberries, tomatoes also, they're all over our supermarket. So here you have 70,000 workers who do not have a contract, who do not have what they should, which is the recognition of their independent union, who are facing the sexual harassment, the pesticides.
And also to go from $7.50 a day, they're only asking to be have their wages raised to $15 a day.
And we're talking about 13-hour days, too. They're trying to go to 8 hours. Eddie, what is being asked of people in this country since this is the holiday? This is what must we do? Is it a boycott? Is it what do we need to do about Driscoll?
We need to boycott them. Exactly. I think people should be mindful and not take for granted the hard work and the labor that goes into the food that we consume at our dinner tables.
So let's be absolutely clear now. We have at least 70,000 workers fighting for the recognition of their independent union. They want to go from $7.50 per day to $15
exactly.
An hour.
A day.
We're talking a day. $7.50 a day.
Let's get that clear
because, you know, you become so formulaic in your understanding of things sometimes. Yeah, I almost did that. I almost thought $7.50 an hour. No, we are talking about workers who make $7.50 per day. They work 13-hour days. They're fighting for an 8-hour day, and they're fighting from $7.50 per day. It is what my grandmother used to say. It is a shanda. It is a disgrace. And we really want to thank Al. Yes, Al.
If I can make a clarification, the word government was mentioned in regards to the San Quintin workers. We have to define here what we're talking about. The fact is that they were negotiating with the government because the government was refusing the actual laws and benefits on the books as it relates to overtime, Social Security, and the question of women being pregnant, having time off, and being paid for it. That's different from having to deal with the employers meeting the demands of recognizing the union, which they have refused to do so, and refused to meet along with the government. So we have two things here that we got to clarify. One thing is the government.
Well, I'm afraid that we are going to have to come back another time to continue to clarify these issues. But I think that we do have the major thing, which is they get $7.50 per day. They work 13-hour days. They lack health care. They lack overtime pay. They are put in a position, as Eddie Rosario said, about increased debt from company stores. And the sexual harassment is demonstrative and aggressive. We have a lot of work to support our sister farm workers in the Valley of San Quintin, Baja California, Mexico.
Boycott Driscoll Farms. Boycott Driscoll Farms.
Absolutely. And we want to thank our brothers for being with us. Eduardo Rosario, president of the New York City chapter of the Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, and a long-time organizer, Al Rojas, a founding member of the United Farm Workers and president of the Sacramento Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Boycott Driscoll Farms. Boycott Driscoll Farms. And let the stores that you know and shop in know that you are going to not shop in their stores if they don't remove Driscoll from their shelves until they have a real contract and recognize the independent union for these workers. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The only minority group that you can join overnight.
From Overnight Productions.
In the twinkling of an eye, in fact.
I am going to do everything I can to stop this election from degenerating into an attempt to pit one group of Americans against another.
Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct.
They deprive a targeted group of people of basic constitutional rights.
Let's find out how we can live together with our differences.
We're not trying to destroy the family. We want to have families and be accepted by our families.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Walmart settles for millions in queer spousal benefits claims. Malta leads Europe in banning queer therapy. And remembering North Carolina's Colorado ancestor. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending December 10th, 2016. Global retail giant Walmart settled a lawsuit this week for an announced $7.5 million to cover claims for spousal benefits that the company denied to its lesbian and gay workers. The class action lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts was filed in 2015 by the Boston-based group GLAAD, GLBTQ legal advocates and defenders, on behalf of Walmart employee Jacqueline Cote. She repeatedly tried to add her wife, Diana Smithson, to her health insurance coverage between 2006 and 2012 and was denied each time. The company changed its policy in early 2014, a year after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down key provisions of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. But by then, Smithson's ovarian cancer had cost the couple close to $150,000 in medical bills. Smithson died in March. Cote, who's worked at Walmart's in Massachusetts and Maine since 1999, said in a press statement that she was pleased with the settlement and that it's a relief to bring this chapter of my life to a close. The agreement, which must still be formally approved by a judge, would cover health insurance claims made by the company's married LGBTQ couples between January 2011 and December 2013. Walmart is the largest retailer in the world, the biggest private employer in the world with over 2 million employees, and the largest private employer in the United States.
North Carolina's embattled Republican Governor Pat McCrory has finally thrown in the towel. Almost a month after voters went to the polls in the extremely close election, and after McCrory had claimed voting irregularities and had actually challenged the count in one liberal stronghold of the state, the Republican governor, who bucked Trump's GOP landslide, conceded defeat in a video message on December 5th. McCrory became notorious around the world for his staunch defense of the state's HB2, a law that prohibits local governments from protecting their LGBT residents from discrimination and requires transgender people to use birth certificate-based public bathrooms.
We have not taken away any rights that currently existed in any city in North Carolina.
Lies, lies, that's all I ever get from you.
The so-called bathroom bill cost the state many millions of dollars through boycotts by businesses, entertainers, sports associations, and faith and philanthropic groups. Voter exit polls showed that McCrory's defense of HB2 may have made him the first governor in North Carolina history to lose a re-election bid.
Goodbye.
McCrory's Democratic successor, current Attorney General Roy Cooper, refused to defend HB2 in federal lawsuits against it and strongly supports repeal. That could be a real challenge because the state legislature remains under dominant Republican control.
U.S. President-elect Donald Trump continues to fill his key administration positions with retired generals, Wall Street insiders, and right-wing business moguls. In addition to growing concerns from labor, environmentalist, and civil rights groups about Trump's choices, Each of the latest nominees has a pronounced unfriendly record on LGBTQ issues. Retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, one-time challenger to Trump in the GOP primaries, has been tabbed to lead HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The former Tea Party favorite has called gay people abnormal, equated marriage equality with bestiality, and compared being transgender with changing ethnicities. Carson said only a few weeks ago that he was not interested in a position in the Trump administration because, a spokesman said, he has no government experience. There are no evident professional or community activities on Carson's resume that would seem to qualify him to head a federal government agency charged, among other things, with enforcing fair housing laws. But Trump seems to think Carson, who's black, can advance what the president-elect calls his urban renewal agenda.
Trump's other recent choices include Steve Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary. He headed California-based One West, a company accused of racial discrimination in lending.
Trump's picturehead, the Environmental Protection Agency, Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt, is a climate change denier who's previously said that the EPA should be abolished.
Incoming CIA Director Mike Pompeo voted against reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act as a congressman from Kansas. He's voiced opposition to marriage and adoptions equality and has supported a federal version of a law that would allow discrimination against LGBTQ people based on sincerely held religious belief.
Retired four-star general and soon-to-be Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly spoke out against opening combat positions to women earlier this year because they would lower military standards. And, President Obama's efforts notwithstanding, he supports continued operation of the Guantanamo Bay internment camp.
If for no other reason than guilt by association, Transportation Secretary nominee Elaine Chao is the wife of Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who during his tenure has been a consistent opponent of pro-LGBT legislation.
Those in our audience who are old enough may recall the boycott of the Carl's Jr. fast food restaurant chain because of the company's financial support of anti-gay causes, including an effort in the late 1970s known as the Briggs Initiative to ban lesbians and gay men from teaching in California's public schools. President-elect Trump has picked current Carl's Jr. chief executive Andy Puzder to be Secretary of Labor. He's voiced strong opposition to raising the federal minimum wage and has railed against government workplace regulations.
And reports were swirling late this week that Trump would name Rex Tillerson, the CEO of global energy conglomerate ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. ExxonMobil is one of the few Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. without spousal benefits for the partners of its lesbian and gay employees, and only belatedly instituted workplace anti-bias provisions.
In other news, the Arkansas State Supreme Court overturned a lower court decision late this week that would have allowed married same-gender couples to list both parents on their children's birth certificates without obtaining a court order. Justice Josephine Hart wrote for the narrow majority that the ruling does not violate equal protection to acknowledge basic biological truths. A lower court ruled last year that the U.S. Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling automatically allowed married gay and lesbian couples to have both of their names listed. Not having both names on their child's birth certificate can create obstacles for the parents, such as getting health insurance or even being able to pick up a child at school. Married heterosexual couples are generally allowed to have both parents listed on a child's birth certificate without having to jump through any legal hoops. The attorney for the three same-gender couples in the case said she was not sure yet if her clients want to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Meanwhile, on the heels of last week's unprecedented apology by South Australian Premier Jay Weatherill to LGBT people for years of persecution and discrimination, state lawmakers have voted to recognize the civil marriage of a gay man whose husband died on their honeymoon. It allows the surviving spouse, Marco Bulmer Rizzi, to be listed as next of kin on the death certificate, reversing the never married designation. The South Australian Parliament also opened adoptions to same-gender couples this week, leaving the Northern Territory as Australia's only state to deny its children loving adopted same-gender couples.
Greece's parliament approved legislation this week to expand the rights of same-gender couples and protect LGBT people from discrimination in the workplace. The vote was a lopsided 201 in favor and only 21 opposed. 73 MPs were absent. Greek civil partnerships were created late last year in response to a European Court of Human Rights ruling criticizing the country for anti-queer bias. Even though couples in civil partnerships are still denied joint adoption or access to fertility services in Greece, the new laws are also said to include some of the toughest provisions in Europe against hate speech and hate crimes.
Parliament in the tiny nation of Malta made it the first in the European Union to outlaw so-called cure therapy that purports to turn LGBTQ people straight. The new laws impose fines and jail terms for anyone who offers, performs, or refers an individual to another person who claims to perform so-called conversion or reparative therapy. The legislation also affirms that no sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression constitutes a disorder, disease, or deficiency of any sort.
And finally, a bill to outlaw so-called cure therapy for minors in upstate New York, called the Prevention of Emotional Neglect and Childhood Endangerment, has raised a few eyebrows in Washington. Erie County legislator Patrick Burke may not have spelled it out, but the apparent namesake of his bill is a self-identified Christian conservative Republican in that order. He's claimed that being gay is a choice, and as a congressman, he voted for a measure that would have constitutionally banned civil marriage equality nationwide. As Indiana governor, he pushed a so-called religious freedom bill to create state-sanctioned anti-LGBT bias. He also proposed diverting funding designated for HIV/AIDS prevention and education to gay conversion therapy. Yep, the Prevention of Emotional Neglect and Childhood Endangerment Bill is named for Vice President-elect Mike Pence.
That's News Wrap for the week ending December 10th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Carol Myers.
We're counting down to a historic This Way Out program 1500 at the end of the year and finding lots of historic moments along the way, like the classic clash in Colorado we'll recall later in the program. But first, here are some historic facts Vice President-elect Mike Pence probably wishes he had known before he bought those tickets to a certain Broadway show.
Alexander Hamilton, first Secretary of the Treasury, coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Alexander Hamilton was a hero in the Revolutionary War and later the first Secretary of the Treasury under President George Washington. He was born in 1757 in the West Indies. As a highly intelligent youth, he came to America and began his education. He was soon sidetracked, joining the colonial army as an officer. Because of his evident abilities, General George Washington chose Hamilton as his advisor. Hamilton had relationships with both women and men, the most intense bond being with fellow advisor John Laurens. When they were apart on military assignments, they exchanged affectionate letters. Hamilton once wrote to Laurens saying, "I wish, my dear Laurens, it might be in my power, by actions rather than words, to convince you that I love you." In 1782, Laurens was killed in a military skirmish, and Hamilton felt the deepest affliction at the news. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Jay White.
You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters.
I'm Harvey Milk. I'm a supervisor in San Francisco. And I'm gay.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
And here comes the National March on Washington for lesbian gay rights.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Today, I finally get to look at the man that I love and say, "Will you please marry me?"
Ladies and gentlemen, the next president of the United States, Donald Trump.
As an African-American, as an openly gay man, and as an American, that frightens me.
I hate to say that Donald Trump unified us with that one.
Whatever it takes.
Our latest CD special, Trump Trauma and the Dawn of the Donald, is hot off the presses and available now at thiswayout.org. And remember, This Way Out's queer history CDs make unique holiday gifts, too. The year was 1996. The U.S. Supreme Court decision upholding state laws that criminalized private consensual adult same-gender sex had been in effect for a decade, and it would take another 7 years before that ruling would be overturned. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was 2 years old, and the Defense of Marriage Act was just weeks away from passage. It's been 20 years now since the highest court in the land concluded that gays and lesbians were entitled to equality under the law, a frequently forgotten ruling that laid the foundation for virtually all of the court-ordered legal advances for the LGBT community that have followed. The case involved Colorado's Amendment 2, a ballot initiative whose purpose seems eerily similar to North Carolina's discriminatory HB 2 of today. We're taking a look back at Amendment 2 as we count down to This Way Out number 1500. But first, let's set the scene with NewsWrap's Cindy Friedman reporting on the competing queer-related U.S. headline story for the week of May 20th, 1996.
In the U.S., legislative activity continued against recognition of gay and lesbian couples. This week, U.S. President Bill Clinton himself made a clear statement that he would sign DOMA, the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, if it came to his desk in its current form.
As I understand it, the only legal effect of the bill is to make it clear that states can deny recognition of gay marriages that occurred in other states. And if that's all it does, then I will sign it. Now, having said that, I do not favor discrimination against people because they're homosexual. And you ask me what I would say to gay Americans who may disagree with me about this issue, I'd say, look at my record. Name me another president who has been so pilloried for standing up for the fact that we shouldn't discriminate against any group of Americans, including gay Americans, who are willing to work hard, pay their taxes, obey the law, and be good citizens. And let me just say, even though I will sign this bill, if that's what it does, and that's what I understand it does, this is hardly a problem that is sweeping the country. No state has legalized gay marriages. Only one state is considering it. We all know why this is in Washington now. It's one more attempt to divert the American people from the urgent need to confront our challenges together. Now, that's really what's going on here. This has always been my position on gay marriage. It was my position in 92. I told everybody who asked me about it, straight or gay, what my position was. I can't change my position on that. I have no intention of it. But I am going to do everything I can to stop this election from degenerating into an attempt to pit one group of Americans against another. Every time we do that, the American people make a mistake. We are a better country than that. We're a greater country than that. And we ought not to do it. And I'm going to do what I can to stop it.
And sign DOMA he did. In the dead of night, without ceremony, and without allowing the religious right to use marriage equality against him in the upcoming presidential election. What Bill Clinton could not have guessed in 1996 was that the case to watch was not the pending marriage rights lawsuit in Hawaii, but the long-running anti-discrimination battle in Colorado.
For the first time in the history of the United States, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that gay and lesbian Americans are entitled to equal protection under the law.
We got a good decision, folks. It's going to have an impact for many, many years to come. And we all made it possible here in Colorado.
In its most important ruling impacting lesbian-gay rights in the past decade, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Colorado's Amendment 2. The voter-passed referendum, which prohibited statewide anti-discrimination protections for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, attempted to amend the Colorado Constitution in order to overturn protections that had been passed in the cities of Denver, Boulder, and Aspen. The measure would have also prevented similar protections from being enacted elsewhere in the state.
The first judicial shot against Amendment 2 was fired by Denver District Court Judge Jeffrey Bayless in January 1993, 2 months after 53% of Colorado voters passed the initiative.
Do the plaintiffs have a reasonable probability, given all of the law that the court has examined, of proving that Amendment 2 is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt? Yes. The motions for preliminary injunction are granted, and the defendants, the governor of the state of Colorado and the attorney general of the state of Colorado, are enjoined from declaring Amendment 2 in force and are enjoined from enforcing Amendment 2 until further order of court.
Bayless eventually made the injunction permanent, and on appeal, the Colorado Supreme Court agreed that Amendment 2 violated the state constitution. Finally, on May 20th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the case entitled Romer v. Evans that the measure violated the U.S. Constitution. Ironically, the decision came almost to the day on the 100th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Plessy v. Ferguson ruling, which upheld separate but equal accommodations for African Americans.
Writing for the 6-3 majority, Reagan appointee Justice Anthony Kennedy said Amendment 2 was contrary to the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause because it limited the ability of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals to equally participate in the political process. In his 14-page ruling, Kennedy dismissed the state's argument that anti-discrimination protections gave gays, lesbians, and bisexuals special rights. He wrote, "The amendment withdraws from homosexuals, but no others, specific legal protection from injuries caused by discrimination, and it forbids reinstatement of these laws and policies." He further noted that Amendment 2 unfairly identifies persons by a single trait and then denies them protection across the board, an act he called unprecedented in our jurisprudence. "We must conclude that Amendment 2 classifies homosexuals not to further a proper legislative end, but to make them unequal to everyone else. This Colorado cannot do. A state cannot so deem a class of persons a stranger to its laws."
That rebuke was received with indignation by Colorado Attorney General Gail Norton, who argued in support of Amendment 2 before the Supreme Court.
"The court's decision is insulting to the Colorado voter. It mocks the democratic process. Frankly, I expected much more from the United States Supreme Court."
Boulder attorney Gene Dubofsky, who argued the case against Amendment 2 before the court, had this response to the charge that the decision undermined the democratic process.
"The court said, voters of Colorado, you may have adopted this, but it deprives a targeted group of people of basic constitutional rights, and that can't stand."
The court's three most conservative members, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, and Chief Justice William Rehnquist, issued a bitter dissenting opinion. Citing the last major Supreme Court ruling involving lesbian rights, the 1986 Bowers v. Hardwick decision, which upheld the state of Georgia's right to criminalize consensual adult homosexual sexual activity, Scalia wrote, "If it is rational to criminalize the conduct, surely it is rational to deny special favor and protection to those with a self-avowed tendency or desire to engage in the conduct. Amendment 2 is designed to prevent piecemeal deterioration of the sexual morality favored by a majority of Coloradans. Striking it down is an act not of judicial judgment, but of political will."
The court's decision in the case elicited predictably favorable response from the major U.S. lesbian gay rights organizations, although most cautioned that the ruling does not guarantee gay and lesbian rights in America.
"Lesbians and gay men are exactly where they were before, which is without protection."
The Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund's Beatrice Dorn.
"Essentially, where we are is we are free to seek, by legislative means, protections against the discrimination which we suffer."
"The important thing to understand with today's ruling is that gay people can still be fired in 41 states in the United States."
The Human Rights Campaign's David Smith.
"This court decision is a welcome decision in light of the congressional gay bashing that has taken place in the last couple of weeks. The anti-gay marriage bill that is introduced in Congress 2 weeks ago, and they had hearings on it last week, 2 years before any law will manifest in Hawaii that could actually make it possibly legal for gay people to get married, begs the question, don't they have anything better to do?"
Will Perkins, chair of Colorado for Family Values, which engineered the placement of Amendment 2 on the state ballot and campaigned for its passage, repeated the standard argument used to promote the measure.
"You see, it's important to understand that Amendment 2 was never about people. It was about conduct. And to give a conduct that is considered to be reprehensible by the majority of people and put it into some kind of a preferred status, in my view, is an extremist action."
Kevin Thibodeau, who founded Colorado for Family Values but left the organization earlier this year under a veil of suspicious accusations, also repeated the religious rights argument that protecting gays and lesbians from discrimination would open the floodgates to moral destruction.
anything goes. Because of this ruling, there will be no logical or reasonable explanation as to why pedophilia, why bestiality, why bigamy and polygamy cannot be denied to anybody that claims it.
Evan Wolfson, director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund Marriage Project, said the Supreme Court's Amendment 2 decision could favorably impact the current campaign for same-gender marriage. Wolfson pointed specifically to the court's conclusion that no legitimate government purpose was served by denying gays and lesbians equal protection. There are also four federal appeals court cases dealing with the issue of open gays and lesbians in the military, and Michelle Beneke of the Service Members Legal Defense Network described the Amendment 2 ruling as incredibly important to all gay and lesbian litigation. For the first time, gays and lesbians are recognized as citizens under the Constitution.
Colorado's Governor Roy Romer, who had urged defeat of Amendment 2 during the 1992 campaign and is the only governor to veto anti-same-gender marriage legislation this year, said he hoped for reconciliation among the battling partisans.
Now, I know the issue of sexual orientation is one on which many disagree, but I make this appeal. Let's find out how we can live together with our differences rather than spend our time dividing over this issue.
Priscilla Inkpen, a Boulder County minister, says she was a bit surprised to be thinking about how the pro-Amendment 2 forces must be feeling, and also stressed the need for reconciliation.
But I really want to say that to the people who feel like they've lost today, that we're not trying to destroy the family. We're not trying to destroy American values. We want to uphold American values. We want to have families and be accepted by our families and be able to live in this society. And that's what this case has been about.
Colorado, Colorado. When the world leaves you shivering and the blizzard blows, when the snow flies and the night falls, there's a light in the window and a place called home. At the end.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Carol Myers, and Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Jay White contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Sweet Honey and the Rock and Judy Collins performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and the individual listener donors who made this program possible. Join the countdown to This Way Out number 1500 and find out the three things you can do to add your support at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KHEN Salida, Colorado, Chiampa Radio Tampa, Florida, 3CR Fitzroy, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio and KPFA. My name is C.S. Song. Alan Watts, the philosopher and comparative religion scholar, was one of the foremost interpreters of Eastern thought and philosophy for audiences in the U.S. The author of more than two dozen books, Watts also happened to be a programmer at KPFA in Berkeley for 20 years, beginning in 1953. He was also a sought-after lecturer and presenter. Today, the last day that we come to you to ask for your support for Against the Grain during this KPFA's December Fund Drive, we present portions of two talks that are part of the Alan Watts Library Collection, which is a compilation of 28 hours worth of talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of two decades. Later this hour, we'll present a talk called Insight and Ecstasy, but we begin with portions of a presentation by Watts on the fundamentals of Buddhism. And by the way, the sprawling 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection is your thank you gift for a one-year, $180 pledge to listener-supported. We can't do it without people like you because we resolutely don't take corporations or underwriters' money. KPFA. The phone number to call anytime this hour is 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. Easily remembered as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And if you call, you can break the $180 down into six monthly installments of $30 each. Let's turn out excerpts from a presentation by Alan Watts called Fundamentals of Buddhism. When he refers, by the way, to Gautama, he's referring to the 6th century BC Indian figure whom we identify as the Buddha. We take up Watts' talk as he's discussing a certain kind of freedom.
Freedom from an emotional habit, the habit of grasping at one's own life, at seeking for continuity. And you see, the idea of continuity in Buddhist philosophy is that we desire continuity in order to perpetuate our past. In our past, in other words, we have accumulated various things, experiences, material goods, knowledge, virtues, power, so on. And the desire for continuity is the desire for the perpetuation of a past self or string of selves with which we identify ourselves. And Buddhist insight involves the recognition that the past is perpetually vanishing. There really is no past to continue, and therefore to cling to it, to identify oneself with it, is to perpetuate an illusion resulting in incessant frustration. Now, Gotama made it very easy to summarize his teaching. He was really quite an adept in what we call mnemonics, in putting things in simple form so that they could easily be remembered. And he summed up the whole of his doctrine in what is called the Fourfold Noble Truths. And it's based on an old medical formula. In ancient India, as in almost all ancient cultures, every activity was ceremonialized. And when a physician came to pay his call, he gave his diagnosis in a ceremonial way. He made four pronouncements. The first pronouncement was the name of the disease. The second, the cause of the disease. The third, the curability of the disease. Can it be cured? Yes or no? And if it can be cured, the fourth pronouncement is the giving of the prescription. And that's exactly the form of Gotama's summary of his doctrine. He said, in other words, the first principle is that mankind, and indeed all forms of life, suffer from a disease, which is called in Sanskrit dukkha. And the most general translation of that word is suffering. Dukkha means suffering in all its forms: moral, physical, spiritual. But Western interpreters of Buddhism have sometimes represented him as saying that life is suffering, period. In other words, of enunciating a highly pessimistic and world-hating doctrine that to be alive is to suffer. And that, in other words, the amount of joy, of positive pleasure in life is, after all, so negligible that the game is not worth the candle. Now, if one studies the method of teaching of sages in ancient India, you have to realize that one of their fundamental pedagogical gambits is to arrive at the point of view they wish to inculcate by a zigzag method. When we walk, you know, we put down maybe first the left foot, then we shift to the right foot, then the left foot, then the right foot. And in this way, we go along, neither to the left nor to the right, but straight ahead. And you find, too, that in thought, that the human mind tends to go from position to position, but it always, when it settles on any fixed position, we can always point out that that position is an extreme. For example, in scholastic philosophy in the Middle Ages, when St. Thomas Aquinas fastened on the idea that God is fundamentally ends or being, a Buddhist philosopher would point out that he had settled upon an extreme that has an opposite, non-being, and that therefore his position needs to be corrected by the opposite position. Somebody else should get up and say, no, no, God is not being, God is non-being. And from this facing of opposites with each other, we arrive at what Buddhism is sometimes called the middle way. Doesn't mean the compromise position. The middle way is the doctrine of relativity, of showing that all positions or experiences which we can formulate must always be perceived or known by contrast with their opposites. So in other words, Buddha's doctrine that life is fundamentally dukkha or suffering is an antithesis directed towards those people who believe that the object of life is to attain sukha or sweetness, pleasure. He is saying, in other words, you cannot experience pleasure except in reference to non-pleasure. And therefore, the more you pursue pleasure, the more non-pleasure will arise to frustrate you. The more you pursue permanence, the more you will feel the impermanence of things. And so it is, for after all, when we are bent on enjoying ourselves, we become at that very moment curiously aware of how rapidly time is slipping by. When, on the other hand, we are not enjoying ourselves, we become curiously aware of how time is dragging. So then, dukkha, arising from an exaggerated pursuit of sukha, its opposite, becomes the basic characteristic of life. And he goes on to say, in his second principle, that the cause of this is trishna or grasping, sometimes translated desire, and indeed I believe the word trishna does underlie etymologically the English word thirst. But trishna is not quite desire. For example, one's appetite. When you haven't eaten for some time and you get hungry, this is not trishna. It's a perfectly natural occurrence. Trishna is based in turn on avidya, which means unwisdom or simply lack of insight, lack of consciousness, lack of, well, a special sense of ignorance, not the ordinary sense of ignorance of not being informed, but ignorance, action based on ignoring something. And ignorance is not realizing the relativity of experiences, not realizing the inseparability of pleasure and pain, existence and non-existence, life and death, up and down, good and bad. So that as a result of such ignorance or unwisdom, people try to separate these opposites from each other, to corral, to gain the good ones, and to exclude and annihilate the bad ones. And as a result of that, because these opposites exist mutually, they go round in circles. And that mutual existence of these opposites is really, it seems to me, the basic meaning of the doctrine of karma, which is involved in Buddhism, the doctrine of conditioned action, which Buddha epitomized in the phrase, this arises, that becomes. In other words, without this on the one hand, or this on the one hand always implies that on the other, good on the one hand implies bad on the other, and so on and so forth. And so, if a person becomes involved in karma, involved in conditioned action, leading to a vicious circle, if he is ignorant of the interdependence of all states of experience. So then the third truth, the cure of this dukkha or suffering, is the truth about nirvana. Nirvana is the most grossly mistranslated word in all foreign languages, probably. Because we are early scholars of Buddhism translated it as annihilation, and nowadays nirvana means a state of being doped up to most people. It's popularly used as being in ecstasy or in a kind of dreamy bliss. And nirvana doesn't mean that at all. It's a state of being very, very wide awake. State of being completely aware. But the etymology of the word is disputed. There are several etymologies that you can offer, and so I just choose the one I like. And that is to blow out. As when, having tried to hold one's breath, you discover that you can't hold it. You lose your breath by holding it. Therefore, you expire, you despirate. And so you heave a sigh of relief. And so nirvana is the sigh of relief, the expiration or despiration. In other words, the giving up of the attempt to clutch at life, to hold it in a fixed form, to resist change, to separate the good side of things from the bad side and annihilate the bad side. It is the giving up of that fundamentally contradictory, self-contradictory kind of conduct. And so then in the fourth truth, there is set out the Noble Eightfold Path, Buddha's prescription for dukkha. And the Noble Eightfold Path is really in three divisions, one of which concerns itself with understanding, might almost say intellectual understanding of the doctrine. The one is concerned with conduct, and the third part of it is concerned with state of consciousness or meditation. Now, to summarize them briefly, the first stages of the path, such as a right view, or I prefer to translate the word samyak, not so much as right, but as perfect in the Greek sense of telos, or complete. And thus, to have a complete view is a view which does not take sides, which takes the middle path, which in other words does not go off to extremes, and so on. The part of the Eightfold Path that is concerned with conduct. Buddhism is often represented as having a very exalted ethical system, and this is true, in a way it does. But also one must recognize that the difference between Buddhism and Christianity, as at any rate as Christianity is ordinarily taught, is that these ethical ideas are not commandments. They are really forms of expedient conduct. The Buddha counseled his followers to take upon themselves certain obligations, say of not killing, of not stealing, of not exploiting the senses, of not getting drunk or intoxicated with poisons, not lying. Not because these were against the will of God or against the fundamental laws of the universe, but because they are inexpedient forms of conduct for a person who wants to wake up. After all, if you get thoroughly doped up, you're not liable to be very wide awake. And then, finally, the end of the path, the last stages of it, are concerned with one state of consciousness, with the process of what is sometimes called meditation, or of bringing one's mind to its maximum awareness through clear recollection, and then finally the attainment of what is called samadhi, which means integrated consciousness. Consciousness no longer under the influence of avidya, no longer bamboozled and fooled by the apparent separateness of things which are really inseparably interlinked. And thus samadhi could be called integrated, a unified consciousness in which it is seen that the subject, the knower, is inseparable from the object, the known, that man is inseparable from the totality of life, and so on and so forth. So that samadhi at the end of the Eightfold Path might be described as being the entry to, or realization, the making real of, the state of nirvana, which constitutes in turn being a Buddha.
Alan Watts, the philosopher, lecturer, author, influential interpreter of Eastern thought and philosophy, giving a talk called Fundamentals of Buddhism. And that is just one of the dozens and dozens of talks that you'll find in the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection. It's 28 hours of Alan Watts' presentations and talks and radio programs and community presentations, all on three MP3 CDs, and this is yours for the drastically discounted subscription rate of $180 to KPFA, which you can break down into six equal monthly installments if you'd like. 1-800-439-5732 is the phone number, 1-800-439-KPFA. Don't go anywhere, because in a few minutes we'll be presenting portions of another talk that he gave that is part of this Alan Watts Library collection. It's called Insight in Ecstasy. But before we do that, we have a few minutes, and in those few minutes, we've been given a match, because this is the last time I come to you as part of Against the Grain, this December fund drive, and we have a $400 match for the next 3 minutes. And that means that every dollar you give will be doubled to the tune up to $400. So collectively, we want to try and raise $400, which will then be, but only then, be matched by James from Vallejo and Meg from Bolinas, California, who have put up this generous match. So thank you to James and Meg. Great time to call. We also do have a combo pack, which is a dollar a day to KPFA, and that includes the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection with dozens and dozens of talks by this lecturer and philosopher, this scholar of comparative philosophy who held a master's degree in theology. He also taught psychology, comparative psychology, wrote more than 25 books. It includes the Alan Watts Library Collection plus a 3-DVD set, 3 films about Alan Watts, put together by, produced by his son, Mark Watts, who I've had the pleasure of talking to. So you get 3 DVDs about Alan Watts plus the Alan Watts Library Collection for a dollar a day to KPFA. That's a $365 pledge to KPFA. If you've got a little money, and also if you want to give and get some fantastic thank you gifts in return, 1-800-439-5732, which is also 1-800-439-KPFA, which is also 1-800-HEY-KPFA, not H-A-Y, not that kind of hey, H-E-Y, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also donate online at kpfa.org. And we've got now less than a minute and a half to make this match of $400. If you value this kind of information, this is a very deep, very profound wisdom. This is timeless wisdom. This is Eastern wisdom. This is wisdom that Alan Watts is sharing with you in a very comprehensive but also very accessible way. What is nirvana? What is samadhi? Why shouldn't we be clinging and grasping and attaching to things? What are the misconceptions about Buddhism that we have, and how can those misconceptions be cleared up? 28 hours worth of talks that Alan Watts gave over the course of 2 decades. This writer of books that some of which have been translated into at least 11 languages, you can get 28 hours of Alan Watts, and you can have your dollars doubled if you call right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Let's turn now to another talk in this Alan Watts Library Collection. It's called Insight and Ecstasy.
I think it's terribly important to understand that if you're interested in Eastern philosophy, if you're studying Hinduism or Buddhism or something of that kind, with the object of attaining ecstasy, that this is a complete misunderstanding. There must really be a distinction between ecstasy, that is to say, the thrill, the kick, the delight, the joy of a mystical experience, and the experience itself. Because the experience itself may or may not have ecstasy as a consequence. That is simply a byproduct. The experience itself is always a matter of insight. And the insight, the understanding of the way things are, what you are, what life is, may indeed produce ecstasy, because sometimes this understanding is an enormous relief. And that is the reason when one has been battling, say, with some tremendous problem and suddenly finds the whole thing disappears, when you've been terrified at something or anxious about something and all the grounds for anxiety vanish, then very naturally you feel enormously happy and joyous. And also I would add that the kind of insight which is the essence or the core of this sort of experience, has a way of making the ordinary everyday world seem extraordinarily beautiful. And that again is a byproduct. Whereas things before seemed rather dim and oppressive. You know how even on a fine day, if you're feeling sad or depressed, the actual landscape somehow looks dimmer. Whereas on the other hand, if you're feeling wonderful, the landscape itself looks wonderful. And so in the same way, if one has had certain insights which bring about an extraordinary sense of relief from the oppression of certain problems, then very naturally, everything in the world looks a lot better. And you could even go so far as to say it seems transfused with a divine light. Speaking first of all from, say, a Buddhist standpoint, there's no doubt in my mind that the insight in question that constitutes what is called Satori in Zen, or in more general Buddhism, Bodhi, which means awakening, this is not the vision of something like a God underlying the world. Although Buddhist philosophy occasionally uses expressions like the great void, or suchness, or the Dharmakaya, the absolute reality, and thus gives the impression that it has a belief in some sort of continuum underlying the world, in rather the same way that water is a continuum in which fish move and air is the continuum in which men move. There are many, many texts in the literature of Mahayana Buddhism which explicitly deny that this is the meaning. It would be much more correct to describe what they call the void as a state of complete mental clarity, in which one ceases entirely to be bothered by false problems. Because the basic thesis of Buddhist philosophy is that the sufferings, the agonies of mankind, especially the psychological ones, derive almost entirely from false problems, from bothering our heads over questions that are not real questions at all. And when these problems are solved, when it is seen that we were asking the wrong question, then one gets this astonishing sensation of seeing that problems exist only, as it were, in a mental sphere. They exist as a result of thought. Whereas the world which is not thought, the world which simply is entirely free from problems. Now, of course, that is something extraordinarily contrary to our general common sense. We think the physical world is full of problems, and we have thought as a valuable instrument to enable us to solve them. And it's true, thought is a valuable instrument. But valuable, we might ask, for whom? Valuable for those who can use it, but not so valuable for those who are used by it, those who, in other words, are hoodwinked by thinking into problems which would not exist otherwise, and which really have no reason to exist. Now let us take as a simple example the common philosophical problem with which we've been obsessed in the West for centuries. The problems which are called ontology, or the study of being, and the problems of epistemology, the study of knowledge. These problems very largely have to do with the inquiry as to who or what I am, that's epistemology, and who or what the whole universe is, that is ontology. And they derive from what appears to be the common sense feeling that processes of any kind, actions of any kind, have to have behind them an agent. In other words, if we know, we ask very naturally the question, who or what knows? If we see a movement or an action, we ask, who or what moves? And underlying the whole history of scientific inquiry until quite recent times, there has been the urge to know what ultimately underlies the process of the universe. And you see, this has its roots in the historic division of life into two categories. The category of substance and that of function. We always seem to feel that wherever we see activity, operation, movement, energy, that there must be something which does it. Now, many of you who've read the writings of that extraordinarily interesting American linguist, Benjamin Lee Whorf, will remember how he pointed out the arbitrariness of this distinction between events and things. How, for example, he showed that very often in our language, phenomena which are clearly events are masquerading in words which seem to suggest that they are things. And he made some most interesting discussions in his book, Language, Thought, and Reality, about what we really mean by the distinction between these two classes, to which we assign in our language nouns for things and verbs for events. But of course, in recent philosophy, it's become more and more clear to us that we can use verb language, or process language, or operational language to discuss almost anything we want. Any natural phenomenon can be described as doing rather than being. And in general, this is a very useful way of talking about things. We, in other words, dispense with an unnecessary duality in language, an unnecessary distinction between process and entity. And what appear to be entities can always be described in terms of perhaps a slower type of process than the things we've normally described by verbs. And if we consider this, then, and start talking about everything that happens in process language, in operational language, we suddenly see that things or entities, that is to say, the who or what that does something, the agent behind the act, these things completely disappear. A famous instance which Whorf gave of this was in the Hopi language, that when we say a light flashed, the Hopis just say flashed. And he pointed out that's much more accurate because the flashing is, of course, the light. But in this way, we have created a thing behind the act, which is a sort of ghost. And the objective of Buddhist discipline is, as one old Zen master put it, to beat the ghosts out of you. Now, in the same way, you see, when we know something or we act, it's a very basic common sense supposition that we are the agent behind the actor. That, in other words, behind thought there's a thinker, behind experience an experiencer, behind perception a perceiver. And we are, all of us, you see, tremendously concerned with this image, the doer, the agent, which has become our image of ourselves. You might call it our self-image, if you speak in the psychological jargon. And this is the thing we're all concerned about. Its future, its history, its destiny, what's going to become of it, and so on and so forth. But through clarity, it can turn out that this thing that we fancy ourselves to be simply is a figure of thought or a figure of speech, and is not there at all. And the only reason why this makes us feel astounded and bothered and unbelieving is the momentum of a habit of thought. It may become sort of intellectually clear to us that this is so, we still have deep in us the habit of attributing all actions to an agent. And it's difficult for us to realize, to become really clear, that this is only figurative, that there is no, as it were, distinct order of being that is the doer as distinct from the deed. So one is then confronted, when one realizes this vividly, with the astonishing realization that one is not this entity that one supposed oneself to be, that one is not being pushed around by laws of physical necessity. The difficulty is, you see, that thought is, as it were, a system of symbols that stands apart from life and represents it, just as words stand apart from things and represent them. But they don't really stand apart from them. Words are noises, and thoughts are sensations or images, and they only apparently stand apart. Well, as we identify ourselves to so large an extent with our thinking process, we naturally come to feel that we, too, stand apart from life. And as a result of this, we have the customary feeling that when we are not distracted with thought, we are have a curious feeling of emptiness, of having no time, of being very, well, just being evaporating histories. But of course, if you stand apart from life, you're dead. But we don't really stand apart, but we think we do. And therefore, when one recovers from that illusion, and the sense of one's separateness, of one's being a thing, an agent, simply disappears. It's not a kind of fatalistic situation, because the feeling of fatalism is that one is the agent, but one is being pushed around. And so this disappearance and this loss of the sense of separation between the subject and the object, the thinker and thought, and in turn thought and life, could be called, you see, a sense of unity, to which one might, if one were a Christian, give the sense of a union with God. But a Buddhist doesn't give it that sense. And since it involves release from the problem of oneself, the lifting of a colossal burden from one's shoulders, there may ensue ecstasy. But the ecstasy itself has nothing to do with it. It's simply a byproduct of the insight of living in a physical world that is totally free from most of the thought problems, if not all the thought problems, about which we continuously beat our bodies and our brains.
Oh, this is a really good time, I think, politically, socially, environmentally, to try and achieve a kind of equanimity, not so that we can just, you know, lie down in the face of all the turbulence, but to nourish us, to fortify us, and to help create the world that we want to create. And that is Alan Watts. Alan Watts, a legendary lecturer, an author of more than 25 books, a philosopher, a very influential interpreter of Eastern thought. For a number of years, he taught comparative philosophy and psychology. He had a radio program on KPFA for years and years, attracted a huge following for very good reason. His programs consisted of lectures, of substantive talks by Alan Watts. He hosted a radio program here for 20 years, beginning in 1953. And we are offering this sprawling, amazing, high-value thank-you gift, which is the Alan Watts Library Collection on 3 MP3 CDs, because 3 MP3 CDs, because there's so much material here. There's 28 hours worth of talks that Alan Watts delivered on air and in the community, 28 hours of Alan Watts, and it is yours at the discounted rate of $180 to KPFA. It's your thank you gift for a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. $180 pledge gets you this thank you gift. So much Alan Watts, so much insight, so much to think about and to enjoy and to learn from. A lot of it is it's mind-blowing. It's counterintuitive. It jolts at least me out of so many patterns of thinking, so many problems I create for myself. And if you want the combo pack, the Alan Watts Mega Combo Pack on this, the last day that you can support specifically Against the Grain on KPFA, the last 17 minutes that you can do so, for a $1 a day pledge, that's a $365 pledge, you get both the 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection plus three films about Alan Watts, a three DVD set called Why Not Now. These three DVD set plus the Alan Watts Library Collection, it's additionally discounted. $180 for the Library Collection is a discounted rate, but the dollar a day is even more discounted. $365, a dollar a day. You can split it into six equal monthly installments. That's the Alan Watts Mega Pack for today. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to read some of the titles of talks on this 28-hour Alan Watts Library Collection, yours for a $180 pledge to KPFA. Fundamentals of Eastern Philosophy, Fundamentals of Buddhism, which you heard portions of this hour if you tuned in earlier, Discussion of Buddhist Mysticism, Conscience and Concentration, The Art of Psychoanalysis, Paul Tillich on the Eternal Now, Philosophy East and West, Parallel Thoughts East and West, Levels of Magnification, The Study of Asia, The Constitution of Nature, Art, Philosophy, and Self-Improvement, Philosophy as Music, Haiku, Tribute to C.G. Jung. There's a memorial tribute to Alan Watts, The Symbolic and the Real, Man is a Hoax, In the Spirit, on and on. There is so much information in here. If you found yourself interested in and perhaps spellbound by Alan Watts' words and insights, you can get not just 1 hour or 8 hours or 14 hours or 20 hours, but 28 hours of Alan Watts talking to you about Eastern thought and philosophy, not just Buddhism, right? Because he talks also about Hinduism. He talks about Jung. He talks about Paul Tillich. He talks about the spiritual odyssey of Aldous Huxley. But the majority of it is about Eastern thought and specifically Buddhism. And you can get that for a $180 one-year pledge to KPFA, $365 for our mega pack today. We did, by the way, make that match of $400 earlier this hour. I thank you so much for everybody who called in and pledged. He, by the way, Alan Watts, was born in London. He studied with the Buddhist scholars D.T. Suzuki and Christmas Humphreys. He moved to the U.S. in 1939, where he became famous as a leader of the Bay Area counterculture in the 60s. He played a critical role in the integration of Eastern philosophy into the emerging Western worldview of his time. And his talks, all of his talks, all 28 hours of his talks on this library collection are just like you heard, very thoughtful and deep, looking at the big issues, the nature of reality, the meaning of life, the pursuit of happiness, how our minds work, the interconnectedness of things. He tells a plethora of stories. He's a great storyteller. Joseph Campbell, the great scholar of mythology and religion and philosophy, praised Alan Watts' efforts to convey the history and development of Eastern thought. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Again, $180 gets you the Alan Watts Library Collection on three MP3 CDs. It'll play in most any computer. and in many stereo systems, 3MP, or most of the vast majority of sound systems, $180. And again, the $365 pledge gets you the Alan Watts Mega Pack. A lot to choose from, but, well, actually not so much to choose from, but once you get these materials, you'll have so much to listen to and learn from. And so Sasha joins me, but before I bring her in, I want to say, because, you know, maybe you were thinking, oh, I missed the match earlier. I can't get my dollars doubled. Well, actually you can, because since we're in the last hour where Sasha and I are coming to you during this time slot, which is the last Against the Grain program, this fund, it ends, by the way, on Friday, folks. So, if you want to make your tax deductible contribution before the end of the year, we hope to hear from you right now. In the next 12 minutes to the top of the hour, we have another challenge match from Tim from Muir Beach. Oh, I'd like to be on Muir Beach right now. Maybe I can just head out and give the mic to Sasha. And Anna from Berkeley, and they have come up with $750 conditionally, which means they will double your dollars to the end of this hour, which is now less than 12 minutes, coming on 11 minutes. So if you want to make twice the contribution that you could otherwise make, if you want your dollars doubled by Tim and Anna, and you want to get one of these thank you gifts, which is the Alan Watts Library Collection for a pledge of $180, or the Mega Pack, which includes also a three DVD set of films about Alan Watts and about Buddhism and about Eastern thought, give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Whatever you give there will count toward this match. But the match is underway, and we certainly do not want to offer this money back. This is money we want to keep because we want to go steadily. And I say steadily and resolutely toward our overall fund drive goal for this station. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732.
1-800-439-5732. Steadily and resolutely sounds good to me, but maybe also it would be nice if in this final hour, for Against the Grain, that is, of this December fund drive, we could go out with a bang, a resolute and steady bang, maybe. But a bang nonetheless. These listeners are going to facilitate that, or trying anyway, by challenging you to make your contribution right now, and they will match you dollar for dollar up to $750. You know, there's all sorts of great things that you can get in this hour. You can also go to kpfa.org and choose from the many thank you gifts on offer there. Or you might just say to yourself, you know, the thank you gift is clearly KPFA. I'll just take no thank you gifts and give my money fully to KPFA. Whichever way you do it, we're grateful to all the different ways. But don't forget that your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. And since we are in the waning weeks of 2016, this is a really good time to get in there and get your tax deductible contribution. And know that you're giving your money to an institution that was founded decades ago by those who actually wanted to examine the causes of conflict. If you're at all unsettled by the fact that about half your taxes go towards the military in some form, it's a great way to divert it to the cause of peace. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. 1-800-439-5732. KPFA has been here and provided a platform for people like Alan Watts for such a long time, and yet we never can take our future for granted. And if you appreciate the kind of deep thinking that Alan Watts represents and CS does with you on this program, on Against the Grain, then please step forward and show him that you appreciate it this hour while we have a $750 match on the line. It's a great time to give, but it's also the last time during this December drive that you can support our work here. So a vote for deep thinking will be something we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-439-5732. We've got 7.5 minutes to go. $750 on the line.
Alan Watts has got a hypnotic voice, He talks about all kinds of things in this Alan Watts Library Collection, 1-800-439-5732. He talks about technology. He talks about Taoism. He talks about the possibility of human extinction. He talks about school. He talks about conditioning. He talks about social conditioning. And one thing I really like about Alan Watts, I love about Alan Watts, is he is urging us to gain a kind of freedom from habit, from the way we think, the way we perceive, our reflexive responses, our automatic responses. And I really like that. And it makes me, as I go through my world, try and think, okay, well, that's my instinctual way of looking at something. What's another way, and perhaps a more productive way, and a way that will give me not just a better handle on the situation, but a greater peace within my heart as I interact with people and I do my work, more focus and concentration on what I do. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. There you go. You have no excuse for not remembering the phone number. It's incredibly easy. Toll free, 1-800-HEY-HEY. KPFA, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, kpfa.org. We've been getting a great response. We're going to need some more to get to our largest match, I believe, of the drive, which is a $750 challenge match. 1-800-439-5732. There is philosophy in here. There's actually politics, because Alan Watts was quite a political thinker and a political figure. There's a lot in here about how we are socialized, what we are taught to do and to be. And the question he asks is it helpful or harmful? Do we do the right thing by ourselves? Do we do the right thing in relation to our children, to our community? Do we do them justice? So many ideas and insights on these three MP3 CDs that comprise the Alan Watts Pacifica Radio Archives Library Collection. And we would love to hear from you. Your dollars are still doubled. We've got less than 5 minutes left to make this match. And Sasha was talking about me. I want to talk about Sasha for a moment. Maybe you want to support her and her work. I feel like she is, I don't know everybody at the station, but I feel like she is, this is what I hear. I feel like she is the most ambitious programmer on KPFA. She takes these tremendous tasks on. She talks to these authors of books that I can't even approach. And if you appreciate that kind of work, that kind of devotion to her craft, which requires a lot more than I'm sure she's on the payroll for, give us a call. 4.5 minutes left to say yes to this program, to say yes to the work that she and that I do, and to get these fabulous thank you gifts. Let us know Against the Grain matters to you, and the kind of work we do matters to you.
Not sure how to follow up with that, but let me just say 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If people are able to, if you're able to give and get the combination right now of the Alan Watts Library Collection and the Alan Watts 3-DVD set, Why Not Now, for $1 a day to KPFA, I want to really strongly encourage you to do it. We really need to be able to be the strongest station we can coming into the months, the coming year, and beyond. But we all know it's going to be tumultuous. Alan Watts may give you some peace of mind coming into those these tumultuous times, but at the same time, this station really needs your support. So if you're able to give at the maximum level, I guess that's really what I'm appealing to you for. I'm not suggesting that if you don't have the money, you should give anyway. But if you are able to afford it, think about giving at a higher level. Maybe you want to give $1 a day to KPFA and get the combination. Maybe you have $500 and you're able to put that forward, or $1,000. Whatever you can do, think about how important this institution is to you, knowing that we're going into some very dark times, and give accordingly. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and then you can balance it out by listening to Alan Watts and feeling very centered. $750 is on the line, less than 3 minutes to go.
1-800-439-5732. Betsy in Berkeley gave, and she gave this comment, which you can give comments online when you pledge securely at kpfa.org. KPFA is a lifeline for me and my partner. Because of KPFA, I am infinitely better informed, often inspired, sometimes scared, sometimes disturbed, and I value all of this. Thank you, all of you, for hanging in there through all the rough times, internally and from all the external obstacles. Stay strong. If you agree with Betsy in Berkeley on any of what she wrote, we need to hear from you, because if you depend on us like she does, and if you care about us like she does, then become part of the community, renew your membership, become a new member. We love new members. We love renewing members. We've got 2 minutes left to make this match. Your dollars are doubled. What a great time to have your dollars doubled by two generous folks, Tim and Anna from Berkeley, one from Berkeley, one from Muir Beach. Give as generously as you can. Say yes to this program. 1-800-439-5732. Alan Watts is your guide. He's opening a door. He's opening a lot of windows to a room that is one of the best, one of the most interesting, one of the most mind-blowing rooms or venues you can think of. And if you are interested in Eastern thought, if you're intrigued, if you liked what you heard, there is no reason not to call unless, of course, you can't afford it. 1-800-439-5732. Sasha, we can totally make this match. If in the last 60 seconds, and you have plenty of time to call, you make that call and you stand in solidarity with us and with the people we've had on.
Yeah, and I want to remind people that, you know, they call this time the giving season, right, that people give at the end of the year to the causes they care about. They get their tax deductions. And, of course, there are lots of great causes to give to. But when you give to KPFA, you're actually giving to all the causes that you care about. If it's police brutality or civil liberties or labor or the environment or gender, you're giving in the most powerful way to cover all of those issues, to bring them all together rather than having them exist separately. You get a tax deductible donation. You're allowing the station to continue for those who haven't encountered KPFA yet and will find it because you've sustained it. It's such an important institution, I say, and it's so a wonderful time to give. If you're thinking about giving right now, please give generously to us here at KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.